Good evening. This is the Thursday, August 2nd, 2018 regular meeting of the Morro Bay Harbor Advisory Board. We're in the Veterans Memorial Building on Surf Street this evening, and there have been a couple of resignations from the board, regretfully, but for good reasons. I mean, the folks had good reasons, obviously. So we have a quorum present tonight, and we'll begin with, so we'll call the meeting to order, and we'll have a moment of silence, please. Almost silence. Okay, thank you. So then the Pledge of Allegiance, please stand. Okay, that brings us to Chair, Advisory Board Member Announcements and Presentations. So, Gene, we'll start down at your end.
Tide goes in, tide goes out, tide goes up, tide goes down. Still anchovies in the bay, lots of them. A few halibut are being caught, and there's still some of the algae floating around. But a normal, typical summer, as far as I can see.
And the halibut are being caught where?
Usually a lot in here.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah? With circle hooks?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you're not going to tell us where the secret spot is?
Well, all the local fishermen know where the drifts are at.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It'll be a madhouse. Yeah. Owen? Not right now, but any other announcements or anything like that? No? Okay. Lynn?
Yes, the Zongo Yachting Cup will be held on the 11th, Saturday, the 11th of August. It definitely is the biggest race on the Central Coast. For the Ocean Fleet. And we leave from Morro Bay and sail down in a race to Port San Luis. To the breakwater is the end of the race. Last year and the year before, we've had 30, 35 boats, something in there, maybe 40. And all kinds of craft will be out on the water, everything from stand-up paddlers who go that whole distance, kayaks, canoes, as well as keel boats from 20 feet up to probably 50. So all are welcome. There is a website. I'm sure there's a website. MBYC, Zongo Yachting Cup. It's on our website for more information. Or you can call Paul Irving, who is running the race, at 805-441-3344.
Lynn, from how far afield do the participants come? Is it just local folks?
Avila. Morro Bay, I don't think we've had any from Santa Cruz, which would be the furthest.
Okay, thank you. Dana?
Yeah, just a little update on what's been going on at the Maritime Museum. They're continuing their building there and getting closer to their final for occupancy. They're looking at the end of September for their grand opening, the week before the Harbor Fest. They'd like to have a big celebration, so that's what they're aiming for. And there's going to be some paving tomorrow. They've just finished some concrete work for some ADA improvements, and also for the founders, the 1542 founders, which is a group of people who, through a fundraising effort, helped put the building together. And that is going to be a anchor that was donated, and it's a Navy anchor. It's about close to 7,000 pounds, and it's going on a display in front of the building on a big, huge block of concrete, which we call a plinth, holding the anchor. And so you'll be able to see that all put together here in a couple weeks. We're going to let the concrete cure. So I think Saturday they're having an open house. Just kind of a, you know, they'll have the sub open for tours, things like that. So, yeah, check it out. Every day I work there, there are just a stream of people all day long. Come by, take pictures. Then they start reading everything. Then they go to the next boat, the next boat, the next boat. So it's definitely grabs the tourist eye as they come down the Embarcadero.
Thank you. I have nothing, so that brings us to public comment period. For any public comment that is not related to the agenda for the future, to the further agenda this evening, or thank you. So that brings us to public comment for items that are either not on the agenda this evening or for which folks can't stay for the agenda a little later on. Please come to forward and give us your name and where you reside, and try to keep your comments to 3 minutes if you can. Thank you.
Sure. Bill Martini, Morro Bay. It's more of a question than a public comment. I know there's a staff report on water lease sites, several of them, a couple of them out in front of us that we have a proposal on. And I didn't know if that's going to be open for public comment after the staff report. If it's not, I could comment now, but I'll hold off until after the staff report.
Well,
if it's open for public comment after.
It is. There will be public comment when the agenda item is opened.
Okay.
But that is the last thing on our agenda this evening, and my best guess it's going to be hour and a half or something like that before we get there.
So I can make some comments right now. What it is lease site 34W is in front of a piece of property we own, which is Glad's Castle, where the lighthouse is. Originally, Gladys Walton, in fact, I think maybe Gene helped construct the, it's a little four-slip marina. It's coming up in December. The 10-year lease is up. We have a proposal. It needs a lot of work, and there's some issues on access and that. It was going to be put out for an RP. My understanding, it was like 6 months to a year ago, along with lease site 35 and 36W. And I was just mainly checking to see the status on the RFP, and we just mainly want to reattach it to the property where it originally was, and restore the like the pilings. A couple of them have rotted and fallen in the water, and there's several lot of issues with it. And so I was just going to listen on the staff report, and if anyway, that's pretty much it, to see if indeed if RFP is going on that. And also, we've had proposals out for lease site 35-36W for mariculture, and if that's, I understand, but it's also going out for an RFP, and I was just checking on the status of that also. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else for public comment? Well, here's a power duo.
Good evening. Good evening. I'd like to introduce myself. I think I have met almost all of you over the years, but my name is Joan Solu, and I'm a resident of Morro Bay. Can say that now, just say resident. I don't follow that with anything because I no longer own a business here. So, and this is Susan Stewart, and you are a resident.
And I'm a resident and do own a business here, so there you go.
Which is an awesome business. But we are both, I am a board member for the Historical Society of Morro Bay, and Susan is a member of the Historical Society of Morro Bay, and we're keeping our fingers crossed that she will be our newest board member at our next meeting. We'd like to make a presentation to you. I'll make it quick. We have five slides here tonight between the two of us. It's the Historic Society Morro Bay is in the process of looking at how preservation and progress works here in our community. And we have identified a very first historic preservation project that would be a community saving or a community lifting project, and that is the iconic boat building located at 1219 Embarcadero. The Historic Preservation Project iconic boat building would be with the Historic Society of Morro Bay. We're interested in the preservation of the building. We're interested because the building is currently a leasehold, and it's rented to the Tognazzini family, and it's being operated as Tognazzini 3, Dockside 3. The boat building is scheduled to be demolished through a new project that's approved and permitted, and the demolition is scheduled for October 1st of 2018. The boat building was once an actual boat, and it is believed to have been the first non-off-of-the-boat fish market in Morro Bay that was post-World War II. The boat building is historic in that it exceeds 50 years in age and is an iconic landmark for residents and visitors alike. Many people identify Morro Bay with that building, actually. Historic Society Morro Bay has had a 25-year vision and goal of having a museum to present the educational and historic significance of the many artifacts that are currently in storage and have not seen the light of day in some of them over 100 years, and we would like to have them be viewed by the public. The Historic Preservation Project, the iconic boat building, we have had preliminary conversations with the City of Morro Bay City Manager, Community Development Department Director, Harbor Department, I wonder who that might be, the Tourism Department, the Chamber of Commerce, a member of the Harbor Board, the new project developer, the project architect, the Morro Bay Maritime Museum Board members. We have had contact with some of those, and a historic building moving company, along with many residents who are interested in preserving this boat. We believe in the concept of preservation and progress, and believe that those two things do not have to butt heads, but can coexist and equilaterally move forward for the benefits of the community. We would like to work with the community to preserve this historic building. We would like to work with the City of Morro Bay and other partners to create a sense of place and a permanent home for the iconic boat building. The proposal is to use the space as long as needed and as desired as a Historical Society Morro Bay Museum, and to possibly share the space with the city's contractor, the Morro Bay Chamber of Commerce, to house the Morro Bay Visitor Center. The current possible future locations for the Historic Preservation Project are two positions, possibly, on a city-owned triangle lot on the east side of the Embarcadero Road at the south end of the Dynegy plant, commonly known as the Triangle area. The project would create an additional sense of place by locating two museums near each other and the possible location of a visitor center, returning it to the visitor-serving hub of the city, helping to boost economic development, which is a goal of our community. The Historical Society Morro Bay, we believe that the location near another museum, the future Morro Bay boatyard, and the possibility of a visitor center and the Historical Society Museum coming together create a dynamic opportunity for a synergy among a lot of groups to help move the progress of Morro Bay forward while preserving the history. And the city in the past has supported such projects like this that are co-opted. As you know, Dana just spoke about the Maritime Museum, and that's also a co-op that's along the same ideas here. The next steps in our path to preservation is to meet with community partners the second week of August for a site visit, and we would hope that you would designate one or two board members to be there. Meet with the Morro Bay Maritime Museum on August 7th, which is their executive committee meeting we have now heard. I just received an email from them. And they seem to be really open-armed to, actually, all of these groups here seem to be really open-armed to this project to create a sense of place. present at the Morro Bay Tourism Board the second week of August, create a comprehensive budget once consensus is established, present to the City Council in August, which would be optimal, give a full presentation to the Harbor Board the first week of September at your next meeting, should you desire such, secure a location, secure the mover, and meet the October 1st deadline for demolition. We would like to show that Morro Bay can have preservation and progress, and I would entertain your questions, although I know you cannot really do that because it's public comment, but you can reach me directly at solujoan@aol.com or on my cell, which your board chair has. So I look forward to hearing from you. Let us know if you'd, I guess, like us to come back, and I'll let Susan wave her arms and beg off.
I'm excited.
Thank you, and I'm so sorry to take...
I love the idea personally. I think it would be a great asset to our community and love the idea of preserving something that's certainly been here ever since I've been here. So hope you guys like
and,
it.
And well before. It's in the Historical Society's, at least one of their books, actually. Here's what I would suggest, that number one, you send me an email regarding the site visit that you would like any of the Harbor Advisory Board folks who are interested to attend, and I will distribute it to them with the time and the place.
Okay.
And if things move forward in a way that seems to make sense for this to happen, I don't mean your project to happen, I mean what I'm about to say to happen, please contact me not later than 2 weeks before the next Harbor Advisory Board meeting, and we'll consider putting it on the agenda.
Great. Well, thank you very much for your time tonight. And
thank you.
Sorry we went over the non-three-minuted.
Thank you very much. Okay, any other public comment this evening? Seeing none, we'll close public comment at this time. And that brings us to the consent calendar, item A1, which is approval of the minutes from the Harbor Advisory Board meeting that occurred on May 3, 2018. Do we have any comments, corrections, modifications proposed?
I'll make a recommendation. I recommend that we approve those minutes.
So you make a motion to
approve?
Okay. Is there a second? Okay, moved and seconded. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor, aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. Abstentions? None. Carries. Item A2, approval of the minutes from the Harbor Advisory Board meeting that was held on June 7th. And I'm going to recuse myself from that because I wasn't in attendance. But
I will make a recommendation that we approve. Make a motion that we approve those minutes. Over.
Okay. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Okay. Moved and seconded. Any discussion? None. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Are you voting, Owen?
Should I vote?
You can vote the chair. You can vote your seat. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you read the agenda, I know. So, okay. Any opposed? Any abstentions? None. Carries. Brings us to B1, which is the Harbor Department status report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and welcome to another Harbor Advisory Board meeting after our slight recess for July. First item up, Ron, I believe you already talked about our Harbor Advisory Board vacancies with the vacancies, resignations of Bill LaFay and Neil Maloney. It's currently out on the city's website. There's an application and some information in the packet, in the agenda packet. About those two seats, so we're looking for folks to come and apply for that and hopefully get some good qualified folks. The two vacant seats are right now are a member at large and waterfront leaseholder, although when folks are appointed by the city council, so it's a city council appointment process, the council has often sort of rearranged the seat membership just sort of depending on who represents what and who we get applying, so we'll just see where it goes with that. Closing, what's our closing date on this, Lori? Until, probably is, isn't it? Through Friday, August 10th, there it is. Yeah, Friday, August 10th, so you've got until next Friday. So let's hopefully get some folks out for that and thank Neil and Bill for their, I guess, years of service. Bill was on there for a bunch of years, Neil a little less so, but they definitely both put in some good years of service, so thank them for that and wish them well. Recent department activity over the last couple of months, June and July, we've had 39 emergency responses, 214 calls for service, 97 assists, and 62 enforcement actions, and 25 weather warnings. Those were probably small craft advisories for hazardous seas. Been a pretty active summer, as you've seen on our waterfront. There's a lot of people around. Our lifeguards are out there in full force 7 days a week now. They'll be there 7 days a week through Labor Day weekend and then go on weekends only until Harbor Festival. On June 30th, we had our first marine swap meet in the Triangle parking lot. We had about 42 vendors. Basically, we charged folks to rent a booth or rent a space. Had 42 folks come out. I wasn't there in attendance. I was personally on vacation, but I understand there's some good stuff to be had. I'm sorry I missed it. Those marine swap meets are always popular. A lot of good stuff comes out, so we'll probably be doing that again next year, so look for that. July 4th, obviously the July 4th holiday, we had a family fun day at Tidelands Park. Very successful, a solid lineup of people. Had a bunch of kids touring a Harbor Patrol boat. We were spraying water for them on our fire monitor and learning about our rescue operations, so that was a good day down there at Tidelands Park. July 10th, we dispatched to a little girl who was separated from her family and lost and really kind of forgotten at Tidelands Park. At the restroom, apparently she was in the restroom and the family left. Took us and the police department about an hour to find her family, so she fortunately got safely reunited, which is a good ending for that. July 12th, we had a shark sighting within the Morro Bay city limits where we do our usual 72-hour posting. Summertime, so white sharks are beginning to show up again. I know there's been some juveniles spotted here and there between here and Cayucas, and their big brothers and sisters usually aren't far behind, so folks just need to be aware. The ocean, it's like being out in the woods. There's bears in the woods. There's sharks in the sea, so just be aware of your surroundings and keep an eye out for those. July 14th was the 49th annual Brian Waterbury Rock to Pier Run and Half Marathon. Obviously, as the name implies, it's a run from Morro Rock to Cayucas Pier. It's gotten bigger and better over the years and more popular. There's a huge crowd, no major issues reported. It's a one-way run. And then they bus and bring folks back to Morro Bay who leave cars here. The biggest problem with it was the traffic jam of people leaving afterwards. And it's been, you know, not even on events now. Sometimes we get crowded weekend days where the rock is packed, the whole lot's full. All the beach parking areas are full, and typically it happens when the wind comes up in the afternoon. If the wind comes up and it cools the beach off really quickly and everybody leaves at once, it can take you 2 hours to get off the waterfront from the rock up to Beach Street. So we've got a lot of people in town. Also on the 14th, we received a report of a stand-up paddler having trouble. Everybody that has a cell phone now, it's both a blessing and a curse in that people don't have to find pay phones anymore, and we find out about emergencies a lot quicker now because everybody has an emergency reporting device. The curse about it is that we get a lot of false alarms, but we'd rather get false alarms and be safe and sorry than not get the call. So this one was fortunately a false alarm. We found the woman. She was paddling in, and she said, "No, I'm fine." So somebody's perception of somebody struggling was just somebody out paddling. So pretty standard in terms of calls we get. And on the 15th, we were alerted to two climbers on the rock. They were not very far up out of the parking area. By the time we got there, they were down. Turned them over to the police and state parks, who gave them a good talking to. Fortunately, they hadn't gotten up very far. As you know, we've had a number of incidents up there over the years where folks don't always make it down alive. It's not the most safe place to climb, and sometimes folks get up to places where they shouldn't be. So just stay off the rock. It's not a good place to climb, even though it looks tempting sometimes. Recent city council activity, quite a bit of stuff through June and July. The June 12th meeting, the council adopted the resolution to approve the operating capital budgets for this coming fiscal year, actually the fiscal year we're in now, 2018-2019. So those are all on the city website if you want to go look at those. On the June 26th council meeting, council approved a one-year license agreement with the Morro Bay Harbor Festival for them to continue using the yard down at the bottom of the stairs down here. We had put it up for 2 years. Council is desirous of seeing if we can move the Harbor Festival out to somewhere less upfront and desirable in terms of location. So we'll be working with the Harbor Festival to see if we can help them find an alternate location. But in the meantime, they'll be staying there and operating out of where they are. Also at the June 26 meeting, Council adopted a resolution approving a new 32-year master lease with Morro Bay, or with Harbor Hut. THMT is the corporation that owns it, but it's Harbor Hut Inc., Harbor Hut Restaurant. They're going to finish up their portion. So as you know, there was a three-part permit that had what was originally Verges, but now Morro Bay Landing and Great American Fish Company do a bunch of dock and other work. Morro Bay Landing obviously had the most of it, and I'll talk about that more later in the update that we've got as the agenda item. Harbor Hut was kind of the unfinished piece in the middle where they're going to finish their dock work. They're going to connect the two dock sections together, and they've got some other works. They're going to be other work on the lease side as well that they're going to be doing. So they'll be undertaking that hopefully in the not-too-distant future. Also on the 26th, a couple more resolutions that were adopted, upholding a couple of appeals to the Planning Commission, or denying appeals to the Planning Commission that were staked out on a conditional use permit that Verges had for putting a little kiosk, a little information and manned kiosk down at Giovanni's Fish Market parking lot. The two appeals, there was an appeal from some citizens, and there was also appeal from Verges themselves on their own project, and the Planning Commission denied them both and approved the, which basically held the project to be approved as it was applied for. So it's a, say it's a little small kiosk that'll go down there. They'll man it periodically and to help folks get from parking uptown or parking on Beach Street or around other areas down to Verges, because as you know, Verges is up the street just over here on Market, and the boats are down at Giovanni's, and they're not really connected together. So people do still have some trouble finding, because there's not a lot of parking in Giovanni's parking lot back there behind his market. So this is just an aim to try and help their customers get better attached to their boats when they go on trips. The July 10th council meeting, another resolution adopted, approving a new master lease agreement for the boatyard lease site. That site has been a continuous work in progress for me for the last, I want to say, 5 years now. With the failing seawall there and new developments and new things that come up, one of the triggers in the existing lease that was there that would have allowed the tenant there to get out and basically walk away from the seawall repair and file a lawsuit on it, we began negotiating with them again and negotiated some more mitigations to keep them involved with that and keep them doing it. They're back in. And I'll give some update on the lease site item we have a little bit later, too. But we've got them back under lease, and we just did an amendment to their lease. So keep that project going. Hopefully that will get underway shortly. And finally, at the July 10th meeting, the council approved installation of two new fire pits, as I think you recommended in that June Harbor Advisory meeting for the city council consideration, and they took it, and those pits were put out shortly thereafter, so they are out there and hopefully being used. Any questions on any of those before I move on? Lynn?
Could you explain what the code 3 and also codes, if there's 3, then there's 1, 2, 3, and 4, what those codes are?
Sure. So code is police talk. Code 1, 2, 3, 4 is police talk, just like 10-4 means
right.
Okay, or I understand. That's police talk for I understand. The police department, they use a lot of different codes. We try to use plain text as much as possible, but code 1234 is very commonly used. Code 3 is basically emergency. Turn on all your lights and sirens and go as fast as you can. That's a code 3 is an emergency. Code 2 is, it's urgent. It might be an emergency, but not quite. So hurry up, but don't go super fast and drive people off the road with lights and sirens. Code 4 is everything's okay, everything's fine, situation's handled, there's not an issue. And I absolutely have no idea what code 1 is. I don't know if it even is anything. So that's what the different codes are. Gene, you had something?
Yeah, Eric. When the traffic backs up so much, is it possible to have volunteer policemen or somebody direct traffic instead of everybody stopping at the bottom of the hill there and stopping further up on Main Street?
It could potentially be. Our police department is pretty minimally staffed right now, and they would really have to call in volunteers to do that. Although more and more weekends are crowded like that, it's not every single weekend, so it's difficult to plan for specifically every single weekend.
It's almost a safety hazard at some point here, I feel. So.
Yeah.
I have seen that before. I've seen a volunteer down there on the intersection at the bottom of Beach Street and Barcadero. That's happened before. And I thought about it because I was working down at the museum, and I was back and forth, and it was just like, oh, get, you had to get in a line, long line of cars.
Yeah, I mean, the Harbor Patrol, our folks, we respond periodically, usually to fire incidents, when fire department has something that's a fire or a major traffic accident, and they need to direct traffic, and police department's tied up with either other calls they have or life safety stuff, and the fire department's doing their medical aid. We've often, you know, because we listen to them all the time on the radio, and we've often, if it's up the hill, we'll, if we've got people available, we'll go up and direct traffic. And so we're going to be getting the vest, because we really need to be more official about it, get the vest and get the traffic directing training. So it's possible in the future that we could be able to do that if we were available, and since it's right there and in our neck of the woods, and try and get things moving along. I'm sure Becca's going to love it when I give her that idea.
Yeah.
In a whistle? In?
Was the sea lion that was probably bitten by a shark yesterday caught?
I don't think so. I saw the Marine Mammal Center truck at our office yesterday. I might have seen it again today when I came back on a boat tour with the NEP today. When I came back around the corner in front of the Coast Guard boat, I saw that sea lion laying on the dock there. And he's still pretty mobile.
Hmm.
It's hard for him to catch. So I think they took a shot at trying to catch him, but
he's still
alert and healthy enough to where he can't get caught.
Yeah, he got in the water.
Yeah. Anything else? Okay, I'll keep moving. On the fishing front, and Owen, if you want to step in or chime in afterwards, commercial Dungeness crab season ended on the 30th. I'm starting to see traps stacked up here and there as people are putting them away. It was an okay season. It wasn't super great. I think they had some of that domoic acid issue again. A lot of our fleets headed up Oregon, Washington again on the albacore hunt. So recreationally, rockfish is open. Like Gene says, halibut are getting caught in the secret spots in the bay. Lots of rockfish out there. Haven't seen any sea bass yet, but that could happen anytime.
Owen?
Sure. Yeah, I think the last I heard, the albacore is better than last year for the guys up there, and the market's pretty good. So average, I guess. And there's a few guys up fishing salmon, which is kind of a surprise, but there's actually a lot of salmon. But the season is so curtailed that they're just getting a few weeks whack at it at a time. But it's been so windy around here that, you know, black cod and basically all the offshore ground fish has been really, really slow. I mean, the fishing's been fine, but it's been really windy. And then, yeah, I think, oh, nearshore has been pretty good. Nearshore for the live rockfish and cabazon has been real good. And that's...
Thanks for that.
I don't know if I forgot anybody.
Owen, has the word gotten through the local fleet that John at the Morro Bay Aquarium has a large amount of herring, frozen herring, available?
Oh, I haven't heard that. We got an email about his freezer, I guess. But, yeah, I hadn't heard about the herring.
Yeah, he has several hundred pounds of herring.
Oh, really?
Both here and in a coal store down in L.A., and he's very anxious to move it along to you folks.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I can send out an email, write a note, because I imagine somebody would be interested.
Okay. Might be more than hundreds of pounds. It might be in the
might be four
digits. It's a lot, yeah. Like I say, he's got it down in L.A., too. He can only hold so much here.
Well, this one, the freezer up here, his freezer here is 7.5 wide, 9 deep, and 7 high, and there's a lot of 33-pound boxes in there. But anyway, somebody should contact John.
Oh, thanks, y'all.
Morro Bay Aquarium. He's got to move it on. He has to because he's out of there in 60 days. So.
Wow. Yeah, I'll send an email out to the membership.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay, upcoming events. August 7th, National Night Out. It's a community police awareness day. The police departments typically invite fire and harbor and CHP and all sorts of other folks, Red Cross. It's been a good event. We've had it up at Del Mar Park in past years. Last couple of years has been at Cloisters, which is where it is this year. 5 to 7 p.m., you can look up National Night Out on any in the Internet and put Morro Bay in there. It'll give you more information on that. Zongo Cup, the race, we already talked about that on the 10th. Or on the 11th, sorry, 10th annual, on August 11th. On August 8th, the Avocado Margarita Festival in the little parking lot across the street from Rose's Libertine area. That's from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. It's been a real popular event. We'll be again.
That's September. That's September 8th, sir.
Oh, it is September. You're right. Sorry. September 8th, Avocado Margarita Festival, 10 a.m., 7 p.m. You can go to avomargfest.com and get more information on that. And on September 7th is the third annual Taste of the Grove, which is another event put on by the Avocado Margarita folks. You can go to their website and find it there. It's a wine and avocado event at the Packing Shed, which I believe is somewhere out Highway 41, maybe just outside city limits out there in the avocado groves. There used to be an old packing shed out there, so it's 5 to 8 p.m.
I believe that's on Wixom's property, right?
Yeah, Wixom. Yeah. Sounds right.
To the right.
Yeah. If you go to the Avocado Margarita Festival website, you can find the information and where to buy tickets for that on there. Status of pending HAB items. Item one, there's nothing new to update there on the working with state parks to assume the marina and cafe concessions. Interestingly, related to the Morro Bay State Park marina. I toured the bay today with the National Estuary Program, and they were their guest was Mike Stoker, who's the administrator of EPA Region 9, which is the entire West Coast and Guam and Hawaii and everything, and talked a little bit of dredging and fine materials with him because it's the rule that it's got to be 80% compatible with the beach for to put it in our disposal area is mostly EPA. So that made his eyebrows peek up a little bit, so I've got an audience there, so who knows where that may lead. I'm going to follow up on that. Otherwise, no new updates on State Park Marina. Item two, Morro Bay Municipal Code, all our updates on the Muni Code and rules and regulations. I've got nothing new to update there. I'm just slowly, as time allows, picking away at putting together everything to get to the City Council and figuring out time when to get it to the Council. A lot of things that I've got pending to get to the Council. The Council's agenda is so busy these days, especially with General Plan, Local Coastal Plan, and WARF, Wastewater Treatment Plant stuff. Just trying to get a word in edgewise is getting tough. City Council approve Marine Service Facility Boatyard RFQ. We put out the RFQ. That went nowhere. As you know, our next step is to put out a financial RFP for a financial feasibility study to take one last look to see if a boatyard here in Morro Bay be financially feasible. I had that scheduled for the 14th of August for council consideration of that RFP. Due to other things popping up, one of which I'll talk about, Coast Guard project later. I've pushed that off to the 28th of August for council consideration, but hopefully I'm going to be able to get that together and get that RFP out on the streets and get that financial feasibility study done, and then we can definitively know one way or another, at least from a study, whether that yard may or may not be doable. Item number four. Do the update cost allocation plan. As you know, the city approved going out for RFP for a new cost allocation plan study and our master fee, looking at all the city's master fee and impact fees. That went out to bid. The bids came back. The city council or the city team looked at all the proposals that came back. One was chosen. One team was chosen. Firm was chosen, and it's tentatively on the schedule for the 14th week after next, for council approval and council award of the contract. So that contract, assuming it gets let, August, September, October, to start working and meeting with the firm that's doing it, and it's probably going to take several months. The aim is to do it over the winter and then have it ready for insertion into the budgeting process going into next fiscal year. So hopefully we'll see a new cost allocation program. Item five, I've got no new updates. It's a city that can the Harbor Fund share in sales tax and other taxes to go to capital and other improvements. I have nothing new to update on there in terms of any more information gleaned from any sources on that one. Item six, eelgrass, that's on the agenda for tonight, so we'll be looking. We've got our report back from Anchor QEA, draft report on their best estimate based on all the research and interviews they've done on what a probable path to a different sort of eelgrass mitigation and management might be. So we'll hear from that on that item when that comes up. So I don't need to do anything with that. Item 7, working waterfront and land use stuff in the general plan, local coastal plan, that stuff is still all. We fed all our data to the GPAC, the General Plan Advisory Committee, and that eventually feeds into the Planning Commission. That process is still ongoing. There's GPAC meetings that happen on a pretty regular basis in Planning Commission. There's still slated our the grants that we got awarded to put the GPLCP update together are starting to come due from in terms of the timeline. So I think this fall, September, October, November is when that should be getting to the City Council. So we should be seeing that before too much longer. And finally, number 8, paid parking on and around the Embarcadero. As we know, the HAB made some recommendations on things that we should be considering and looking at if paid parking were considered on the Embarcadero. That got forwarded to Planning Commission and City Council. So far, it has not been taken up by either of those bodies to move forward yet. Hopefully someday it will, because I think it's pretty key to our economic future, getting an additional revenue source, a new and additional revenue source. So that is my status report. Any questions on any or all of the above?
Dan, we'll start with you.
Yes, I have nothing to report at this time.
No questions about the staff report.
Oh, sorry.
No questions at this time.
Okay. Lynn?
Yes, I do have a question. That's regarding number 4 with the feasibility study for the boatyard. In view of the fact that Joe's Boatyard is going to be closing soon and the waiting list that they have down at Port San Luis, do either of those facts make any difference in all of the information that has been put together in favor of the boatyard here?
Well, as you know, Lisa Wise...
Let's address that during the... If that's okay, during that agenda item for the boatyard, for the report from the ad hoc committee?
It's an item I'm looking at, we can do that.
Is that okay?
Either way.
Okay.
Remind me of your question, though, because I'm going to forget.
No questions.
Okay. Gene?
Well, I was looking at the application for advisory board members, and I don't see any fee schedule. Don't we get paid?
you actually, this year you get paid twice as much as you got paid last year. Is that okay with you?
Yeah.
Good. That's great. I have a couple of things. Item number 1, which is State Park Marina, just a bit of information. I had the opportunity to cruise the State Park Marina on Tuesday. It was at 11 a.m. There was a +3 tide. The depth of the water along the back of all of the boats that were docked within approximately 40 feet of the shore was 5 feet or less. And a couple of the larger boats were clearly sitting in the mud. So as the city considers what it would like to do regarding the State Park Marina, they might begin to factor in that at some point in time with silting and so on, that the marina is going to become perhaps less and less tenable as a working marina without some dredging, and we talked last year about the cost of all of that. When in your discussions with the state, do they understand what the bottom conditions are in that marina?
They do. I'm just not sure that Department of Parks and Recreation really cares to operate a marina, so they don't put much time, effort, or money into it. They're happy collecting their good amount of revenues that they get from the cafe. We're receiving the revenues and squirrel them away from the marina operation. But they've historically, as we know, which is why we got into the operating agreement, they've not demonstrated any willingness to want to try and do anything with it. I think it'd be fine with just going back natural.
I simply don't recall. Is there a time frame for the operating agreement between the city and the state?
It's a 20-year agreement.
And when does it expire?
We're probably a good 10 years into it.
Yeah.
10, 11 years into it.
So it's got a ways to go.
It's got a ways to go.
Hmm. Okay, and the next thing, I have a question regarding item number 7. Is there a date that you are aware of for the final draft submittal to the Coastal Commission for the LCPGP update?
There are some deadline dates out there. I don't know what they are.
Okay.
I know that we just in our department had a meeting yesterday or today. Today, we talked briefly about it. And it's coming due this fall. You know, the grants stipulate things have to be done by this fall, so it's probably going to be in September, October. That's going to be aiming towards the Kent City Council.
Okay. And my last thing as it relates to the status report. As you announced, there are two and as we know, there's two positions presently available on this board, and I'd like to echo what you said, and on behalf of the board, I'd like to thank Bill LaFay and Neil Maloney for their work. They did, they each in their own particular, in their own topics, I'm sorry, in their own areas of interest and application, put a lot of time in and did some good work, and they will be missed. For those who have interest in these two seats, making application for either one of these two seats, we're hopeful, the board is hopeful, that we're particularly hopeful that there would be applicants come forward that have business and financial experience. That would be ideal for us. Okay. That brings us to the regular items, and we have a representative with us this evening from Anchor QEA, so I would propose for the board's consideration that we move agenda item C3 up to the front so that our guest doesn't have to be here all for a long time. Is that okay with the board? Okay, we're good. Okay, Lynn, you're on. You're on.
Sure, I'll do the intro, and then if you want to feed in what the committee's done and maybe the meetings you've had and some of the info that we passed. So we hired Anchor QEA to look at what might be a path forward to getting some sort of eelgrass mitigation and planning relief from the usual that our leaseholders have of owning eelgrass for 5 years and having to mitigate around it, looking at maybe the Newport plan or a Humboldt plan. Humboldt Bay plan, plans that were recently done in the last 5 years, and seeing if there's anywhere that those plans might help out. So Anchor did their work. They did a fair amount of interviewing with different folks, leaseholders, the city, NEP, the ad hoc committee, came out with a report and brought it to us in draft form. We gave it to the Eelgrass Committee, Lynn and her folks. And so if you want to report on that, and then Jack Malone from Anchor QEA is here. He'll be able to give a real briefing on basically the basics of the report and what he views may be a way forward on it, and we can do a Q&A and take it from there.
So the committee did meet to talk about this plan, the memorandum, but maybe Jack would like to come forward and briefly discuss this for our audience. He'll do a better job than I will. And I'd like to say, before you say anything more, we were really happy with this, and all of our committee members thought you did a heck of a job on it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now I'm hesitant to say anything. After that, I should just go. It doesn't get better than that. So thank you, Chairman and committee, for having me and for moving this item up. I appreciate it. I think Eric and Lynn gave a good introduction, and you're probably all familiar with the core issue here, where anytime you have it could be a maintenance or a development project along the waterfront in the bay that impacts eelgrass, the project proponents wind up caught in sort of a catch-22, a circle, trying to go around and avoid eelgrass, which is just part of the environmental review process. You should avoid impacts as much as you can. If you can't avoid them, then you need to mitigate for them. And the problem that folks are running into is there isn't a really viable method for mitigation for eelgrass. Most of the projects, you know, may result in fairly small eelgrass impacts, you know, a few square meters. And the default mitigation would be to plant another patch of eelgrass that's a little bit bigger to replace the one that may be lost through dredging or a pile or shading or something like that. So that puts all of the project proponents in the business of being, you know, eelgrass gardeners or eelgrass farmers, which is logistically difficult. One, because you need a place to grow the eelgrass and protect it, and, you know, there may not be that property or it may not be the best spot that they have available, and so then they're sort of stuck trying to make the eelgrass successful. So,
Jack, before you move forward, mm-hmm. and you're doing fine, but there are folks who might be listening to this who don't understand what the core issue is as it relates to development in the bay and eelgrass, i.e. you can't simply develop something in the bay without eelgrass being a consideration. So if you could just touch on that just as a foundation point, and then...
Perhaps a shading issue?
Maybe the camp.
How come I can't build whatever I want in the bay?
I see. So on the broader scale, any sort of project has to go through federal, state, local level review, particularly environmental review, and you'll need permits. So if you're going to be working in the water or on the waterfront, you'd need permits from a variety of agencies, you know, like the Army Corps of Engineers, California Coastal Commission, Regional Water Quality Control Board, and they all have regulations about, you know, what you can do, what you can't do. And eelgrass is a special species, so it's considered very valuable for good reason, because it has a variety of, you know, uses in the environment. It's a nursery for little fish. Birds eat it. Serves all sorts of purposes. So, rightfully so, it's viewed as a valuable resource. One of the problems that you face here in Morro Bay is, you know, over the last, you know, 10, 15 years, the total area of eelgrass in the bay has really declined a lot. And there are a lot of folks putting a lot of resources into figuring out why. You know, there are probably multiple reasons, multiple things contributing to that. But that has heightened the resource and regulatory agencies' attention to eelgrass. So if you have a project on the waterfront and maybe you're going to be replacing a few piles, changing the configuration of your dock or making it a little bit bigger, where you might, you know, have to put a pile through a little patch of eelgrass, or you might, in reconfiguring your dock, maybe even to meet, you know, access standards or some other requirement, you might shade a small patch of eelgrass. It might be a very small patch, but because of the decline in the bay, even a small patch is viewed as a big loss. And so that's what's causing the project proponents to go through these gyrations. If they identify eelgrass at their site, they try to redesign the project to avoid it. And, you know, that takes some time, takes money. And, you know, eelgrass can sort of spread or decline, and it spreads through runners. And so if enough time passes, you know, you may come back with the redesigned project and find, oh, now you're going to be impacting another bit of eelgrass. And so even when folks are doing their level best to avoid any impacts to eelgrass and minimize them, there may be times when, you know, some impact is unavoidable, and that's when you get to mitigation, which is essentially, you know, reducing the impact or replacing, you know, the lost resource that is going to result from your project. So there are a few different, you know, major regulations, I would say, that folks should be aware of when we're talking about that. There's a core EPA 2008 mitigation rule that lays out basically the framework for how project impact should be mitigated, and it describes, you know, options like a mitigation bank, where if we're talking about eelgrass, you could set up a huge eelgrass farm and grow eelgrass, and as people impact it, you know, they could pay you to buy a little section, and that would mitigate for their loss. The other, I'd say, big driver in eelgrass mitigation is the California Eelgrass Mitigation Policy. So that was spearheaded by NOAA, so National Marine Fisheries Service, and that lays out for the entire state of California their expectations for how eelgrass mitigation should be handled, a variety of different options, including, like I said, you know, planting your eelgrass garden, watching it grow, making sure it's thick and lush compared to a reference site. But the plan also allows for, you know, whether it's a bay-wide management plan or other alternative management plans that could manage the eelgrass resource and manage any eelgrass losses without requiring, you know, plant individuals to plant and manage their own little eelgrass gardens. So there are, as Eric mentioned, there are a couple examples of those sorts of plans and programs that have been developed in California. One of them is City of Newport Beach. So they have an eelgrass management plan that, in a nutshell, they've been monitoring eelgrass every 2 years for a really long time. So they have a very good handle on what you might call the normal standing stock of eelgrass in Newport Bay. They linked that, all that information, to a maintenance dredging permit that they have that also covers the whole bay. And what that allows them to do is to say, as long as we keep monitoring eelgrass and have an idea of how much is there in total acreage, there's some natural fluctuation in that number. You know, maybe it just changes naturally a couple acres a year. We can allow impacts to eelgrass from small projects, folks dredging around their docks or things like that, as long as it sort of falls within that variability of natural eelgrass fluctuations. In Humboldt Bay, they've developed an eelgrass policy as well. It doesn't go as far as the Newport Beach one. It focuses mainly on what's the ecology of eelgrass in Humboldt. Provides a lot of good background information, but it still leaves project developers to deal with the California eelgrass mitigation policy and other mitigation regulations. It doesn't have a mechanism in place like Newport Beach to allow for some loss of eelgrass without individuals going out and doing their own mitigation. So both Humboldt and Newport are very different from the situation here in Morro Bay. So we set out to try to find, you know, what might be a practical approach that could be implemented in a reasonable amount of time without, you know, costing an enormous amount of money to give project proponents, you know, something practical where they can have some idea of potential cost, potential timelines, and not have to get stuck chasing their tail, going back and forth, trying to redesign around eelgrass. So the core of that plan is the idea that, you know, potentially the city, in coordination with the Morro Bay National Estuary Program, could develop a programmatic mitigation, eelgrass mitigation plan. And so what that might look like is, you know, the NEP folks know the bay and they know the eelgrass better than anyone. They already have a variety of programs going on, restoration programs, sort of scientific study programs focusing on eelgrass to try and understand, you know, how we can restore it in the whole bay. If you were to come up with a laundry list of those types of projects, whether it's, you know, planting additional areas to try and kickstart eelgrass in the bay or do scientific studies, if you had a menu of these projects in order of priority, and you spelled out for each of those types of projects, what are the project details, what are the goals, how is it going to be implemented, and how would you know if it's successful? The city and the NEP could meet with the regulatory and resource agencies and get buy-off on that programmatic mitigation plan, and then when an individual, you know, is redoing a dock and may impact eelgrass, you know, he or she could say, look, we're going to do our surveys. If we find eelgrass that may be impacted, here's what we'll do. We'll make use of this programmatic mitigation plan, and if we're going to, you know, impact 100 square feet of eelgrass, we'll work with, you know, the NEP to identify an appropriate project. Maybe that would mean, you know, funding, you know, planting of 120 square feet of eelgrass as part of a pilot study they're doing. Then I think to increase the efficiency of how all that is managed, if the NEP were agreeable, they could do all the monitoring. And so each year they could provide a report that says we've monitored all these sites. You know, site number one is associated with this dock project. Site number two is associated with replacing these piles or whatever it might be. So you have one single monitoring report that could go to the agencies and handle all of the, you know, required reporting, talk about what's successful. So individual project proponents, again, even if they're paying for all this stuff to happen, they aren't the ones who are having to hire consultants to write plans, do the reporting, you know, do all the diving, represent them to the agencies. It's a lot more efficient. And the city and the NEP working together, I think, would be beneficial because you have more trusted relationships with the agencies. So much longer relationships and much more experience dealing with resource and regulatory agency staff than an individual, you know, developer who may never have had to, you know, work with Coastal or the Army Corps of Engineers. So that's sort of the basics of the plan. I didn't want to take up too much of your time talking at you, but I'm happy to answer any questions you might have or go into any, you know, more details.
Okay, good. Gene, start with you.
Yes, because this was a draft plan, and you are contracted to have a final plan for us, I believe, by end of September. Is that correct?
Well, technically by the end of June.
Oh, okay.
But with the review time,
okay.
You know that. But
there were several questions we had on terminology, and I don't
sure.
remember exactly what they were, but I think Lynn was going to forward those questions to Eric.
I discussed it with Eric the other day, what had happened in our meeting.
Okay.
And I couldn't write it down because the computers were all down.
Okay. Beyond that, one of the things that we did discuss, and maybe Lynn wants to follow up on it, is we were happy what you've come up with a conceptual plan to address the mitigation. We were curious whether you would be interested as anchor going to the various, and I believe there's like five or six different agencies, and getting a straw vote from them, seeing is this acceptable to you or to them?
Yes. So just quickly, any comments or questions you have on the draft plan, definitely you can send them to Eric or send them to me, and we can, you know, incorporate
right.
them.
I don't remember those exactly letters and words that we were concerned about, but I'm sure it will come back to you.
Yeah, so that'll be great. Secondly, I think that would be, that's a very important step, meeting with the agencies. I would suggest, you know, after we think about whatever comments you have and finalize this concept, a critical piece would be for the city and the NEP to talk, and I don't know if that would how far that would have to go to decision makers, but to agree on, you know, the concept and the roles. And once you have that agreement, I think it is very important to go to all the agencies, and there's probably a handful, like you said, and gauge their initial response before you go further. And just yes. and just say, look, you know, we're trying to come up with a practical approach. What do you think? Could this work for you? You know, if not, what would need to change to make it work? And get that first, just that first feedback from them before you go any further.
I believe our agreement was our meeting the other night was that after the stakeholders look at this plan and we accept it, then we would think it would be a good idea for Anchor to go to the various agencies and make sure that they're in agreement with this plan. That's, I think, the direction we would like to go. Is that correct,
Lynn? Yes.
Those are the only comments I have.
Well, hang on. So before we leave that point,
yeah.
So is such an action on the part of Anchor QA in your present scope of work or not? Well, it's just basic business questions. I mean, let everybody know what's going on.
We would be happy to meet with
the agency. That was my next question.
Yes.
So my first question is it in your present scope?
No.
Okay, fine. Okay, and in your professional opinion, straightforward question, is Anchor QEA a qualified entity to go to each of these agencies with a draft plan? With a Morro Bay eelgrass mitigation concept plan?
Yes. So we do a lot of work with eelgrass, and we work for quite a while and very closely with the City of Newport Beach in developing their plan, and we actually administer their plan and their maintenance permit that it's attached to. So we have a lot of experience with that and with the agencies. I actually used to work for the Army Corps of Engineers in regulatory and my training's a marine biologist, so I
is think that by way of saying that the firm has working relationships with each of those agencies at this time?
Oh, absolutely. I work with those agencies daily.
Okay. So we're trying to give the city the information they need to move forward with this, okay? That's where we're headed, okay? And, Eric, contractually, what would be required if this was to come to pass?
Contractually, we'd have to sort of line up a new scope of work, additional scope of work, get a proposal from Anchor, and figure out what a cost might be and bring to the council for approval.
Sure.
It would be a budget adjustment.
Okay, good.
As far as their current contract and where you're starting to kind of go with that is they've spent it and probably more. I think I've got 55 cents left on that contract. So they've fulfilled their contract, and this report, yeah, it's draft. We'll get a final. Obviously, there's going to be one more little last tweak to it, but we've pretty much spent all the money we've got for them right now.
Okay, good. Owen?
So what would be the difference between what you have outlined here versus a regular mitigation bank? I mean, the proponents of the project would fund it as it gives more flexibility, or?
That's a good question, and that's a question the agencies are going to ask as well, and they might think more of what's called an in-lieu fee program. So for both a bank and an in-lieu fee program, you have a sponsor, and it could be anyone, who takes responsibility for the mitigation impacts, and that could be with a bank. You know, you could grow your eelgrass farm, or if you have uplands, you could put a fence around it and say, this land is being preserved for nature. And if I were gonna, cause some impact, and you had the type of habitat I was gonna impact, I could write you a check to mitigate for the impacts I'm causing, and then I walk away, and you as the bank sponsor are now responsible. So if something goes wrong with your property, or your eelgrass farm, all your eelgrass dies, it's your responsibility to replant it. To set up a mitigation bank or an in-lieu fee program, it's a multi-year process, and it costs several hundred thousand dollars, and it's very tricky if you're talking about the ocean, because unlike the uplands, it's not private property. You can't just go put a fence around it and just say, you know, here, it's protected forever. So for Morro Bay, given the scope of the impacts, they're pretty small projects and pretty small impacts. A mitigation bank or an in-lieu fee program, you know, it's too much. It's using a shotgun to swat a fly. So this approach, if the city and the estuary program pair up and develop this list of priority projects, the individual developers would still remain responsible for their impacts and their success, but they would have help in actually implementing the project by the experts at the NEP and the city, you know, sort of setting up this framework. So it's normal mitigation, except it's not every man for himself. It's a more programmatic approach where you're leveraging all that experience from the NEP and, you know, help from the city to put something together. So individuals have somewhere to turn to, and they have a mitigation plan that's already sort of off the shelf. But at the end of the day, that's a very good point, individuals will still be responsible. So if the NEP implements a project with, you know, my money, and at the end of 5 years that project doesn't really work out, I'm still going to have to, you know, pay to make it right. But the idea is it'd still be a big improvement over the current situation. And frankly, the NEP is likely to be more successful in implementing a project than I am as a business owner, because it's not what I do.
So it's kind of a risk pool sort of a concept.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Dana? No, I don't have any questions.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. In our discussion of your memo the other day, there were a couple of things on it that we were sort of uncertain. Under next steps, you talk about developing a framework. And I look at this and I look at your table one with its 6 points and say, isn't that sort of the framework that you're talking about, or do you mean something different, or do we just need more detail on each of those project elements?
I think the most important piece would be making sure the city and the NEP are in agreement on that table and the potential roles, but I agree. We sort of laid that out as a framework, you know, the plan elements and responsibilities. So I think if the city and NEP were both on board and supportive, yes, you could take this, maybe fill in a little bit more detail and go to the agencies.
Okay, that was going to be the next question.
Yeah.
Would it be sufficient for the agencies, for the Coastal Commission, for Army Corps, whoever, to look at this as the framework and get their opinion that, yes, this could be a viable plan for the city of Morro Bay that makes it worth our while to move forward on?
I think so. To be honest, the type of information, when I say you might fill it out a little bit more, the type of information you might add are the answers to the questions that you are asking, because they will have the same questions. So I think that's the level of detail, and it makes good sense to go and have those conversations with the agencies now rather than later, because if they just say, you know what, thank you for trying, but this isn't going to work,
right,
then you're not, you know, wasting time and money.
And that was our idea, that maybe we should take this to the agencies now and not delay nor put more resources into developing it more, mm-hmm. when we can get an idea, or if we can get an idea as to their mm-hmm. Their response to it. The other thing, of course, is in this plan, the NEP plays a very, very large part, and luckily Lexi Bell, the director of the NEP local, has been in our meetings and has given us a lot of really good information. It's been very, very helpful. They will, the Morro Bay NEP will not be having another board meeting until September. I don't know exactly when in September. She didn't mention that. But at that time, she will bring it up to her board of directors and at least get a feeling for what their attitude is then. So in reality, I don't know that we can do much more on this until that board meeting happens with the NEP. If so far, her board of directors has been very willing to have her participate in our committee and our committee meetings and devote a certain amount of time to that. So perhaps they will be willing to go even further and make a bit more of a commitment to start fulfilling some of these steps, such as identifying the potential projects, which will probably be the most important part of the whole thing. Once we have the projects listed and have an outline of the projects, then you can start working on potential costs. And as a question, under this same paragraph, assign potential costs. Those costs that you're talking about in there are the costs for the actual mitigation projects?
Yes. And I think in the broader sense, both the city and the NEP would also have to think about, you know, their costs. And you know, some of that would be administrative.
Right.
And, you know, one of the things we suggested, depending on the level of support, would be, I mentioned Newport Beach has performed biannual eelgrass surveys, you know, for years and years and years, and that's really helped them in discussions with the agencies about, you know, options for managing their eelgrass. If that's the kind of thing that the city would say, okay, you know, NEP, you're already doing these surveys periodically, we can maybe partner with you and help with the costs so that you can have more certainty that you can do them every year, and then that would help everyone by, you know, providing this steady set of data, that sort of thing. So I think those would just be discussions about everyone's potential costs, not just the folks who are doing the project.
Okay. Okay. In Newport Beach, are there surveys done at fixed times of the year, or and so no matter when the project or the actual impact to the eelgrass happens, they still accept those surveys without a they are doing construction sometimes, without an immediate pre-project survey?
Yes. So the surveys in Newport Beach, and it's a large enough area that the surveys take a while, but they're done during the growing season, you know, the warm months
right.
for eelgrass, every 2 years. And so it's one of those things where it takes so long to do the surveys and then to process the data and write the reports, you feel like it's time to start the next one. It's just as soon as you've finished. But applicants, you know, folks who want to dredge outside their dock can rely on those surveys to, so that's another efficiency for them, not having to go out and deal with that themselves.
When you say can rely, because the agencies will allow them to rely upon them?
That's correct. Yeah.
Because here in Morro Bay, the project proponent has to do an initial survey to figure out how much eelgrass is there, and then a pre-construction survey, and then the post-construction surveys, as well as those for the next 5 years after that. That's a great deal more surveying, it sounds like, than is happening in Newport.
Newport is ongoing.
Right. And that's exactly the philosophy, is that they have enough. Lots and lots of years of data, and they're continually redoing it.
One of the factors here that we have to acknowledge in all of this is that the NEP is the can be their budget is variable.
Yes.
It's a federal entity, and their budget is variable from year to year. So we'd have to address that challenge as part of this conceptual plan.
And in fact, that could be a benefit to the NEP that they would have another
augmented funding source.
Yeah, additional funding that could be somewhat ongoing, even though it may not be very large.
And I think that would be a good point to bring up when talking to the agencies as well, because you know the work that the NEP does, I think, speaks for itself in the value that it brings to the estuary and to eelgrass. So, you know, I would think the agencies would be very supportive of helping them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Monitoring and. Okay, so from that point of view, that means without much more work, our next step, it seems, is going to the agencies. Gene?
Not quite, I don't think.
Yeah, thanks for being here. We really appreciate you being here. Just a couple quick questions on the draft report. And in talking about cost, do the Humboldt Bay or Newport Beach mitigation plans have a cost per square meter or something like that? And if so, could we have that included in our final report as an example of cost per meter, something like that?
So Humboldt, the answer is no. So Humboldt Bay, their plan I would characterize as being phased. So what they have right now talks a lot about the ecology of eelgrass and the ecology of Humboldt Bay, but in the end says if you have a project that may impact it, you just have to go through the process. So you're responsible. For Newport Beach, the concept there is they understand just the normal standing stock of eelgrass, and so there's a certain allowance each year, depending on the standing stock, that can just be authorized as loss because it's small compared to the standing stock of eelgrass, and it's within sort of the natural variability year to year. So if you have a project in Newport Beach with a small amount of eelgrass and you're still under that annual limit, you can just do your project without having to mitigate.
Yeah, we've read the Newport report and the Humboldt report. I'm just curious if there's a cost per square meter out there somewhere that we could use as a baseline.
Yes. So if you want some examples of just mitigation cost, so eelgrass mitigation cost, you know, per square meter, there's certainly a lot of those, and we could include those.
Jack, I have a couple of quick questions. The memorandum's conceptual plan, as described on page 5, states that, quote, the project proponents would work directly with the NBNEP to identify appropriate restoration projects, end quote. No, to my knowledge, and I could be wrong, no NEP eelgrass restoration project has been successful to date in Morro Bay. Is that incorrect? I'm happy to be incorrect about that. So let me finish my question.
Okay.
So given that, what, and then the conceptual plan talks about, quote, appropriate restoration projects, unquote. So what appropriate, maybe a better thing for me to ask you is, what appropriate restoration projects are available for this conceptual plan, to your knowledge?
So by appropriate, we were referencing the impact. So does the impact sort of match up with whatever it is that NEP would do to restore, you know, ecological functions? If the impact were going to be, you know, dredging or putting a pile into an eelgrass patch and just directly eliminating that eelgrass, maybe an appropriate mitigation project would be an NEP program that plants eelgrass somewhere in the bay where they think it should do well.
Hence the reference to restoration.
Right. If there's a project that would just result maybe in shading of eelgrass, so you're not directly eliminating eelgrass, but maybe the shading is going to have some adverse effect, and the agency's determination that, you know, determined mitigation is appropriate there, maybe you don't need planting. Maybe it could be, you know, some different type of project that benefits eelgrass that the NEP is doing, such as, you know, putting out the seed bags to try and disperse eelgrass, something like that. So the idea would be that given the small size of the project and the difference of the types of impacts, maybe there could be flexibility in how you approach the restoration.
So the conceptual plan might have an inventory of such things?
Yes, that's the idea, an inventory or a menu of different types of projects in different locations. And, you know, the plan should be quite specific about the types of projects, the means and methods, locations, and that sort of thing, just to make sure that, you know, when you go to the agencies with your permit application and say, hey, if we have eelgrass impacts, we're going to make use of this plan, they know what you're going to do.
Okay, I understand. Thank you. My next question, memorandum's conceptual plan states that, quote, although the NEP would implement the project proponents would retain responsibility for success of the projects. At the end of the five-year monitoring period and funding remedial restoration activities required to meet successful criteria, end quote. So how would a proponent know if a restoration project that they're going to hang their hat on is going to work, especially over a five-year period of time?
There's no guarantee. So in that way, this is still what the regulations would call permittee responsible mitigation in that sense. If it fails, it's still the person holding the permit's responsibility to make it right. That's not ideal. In, you know, it'd be a lot easier if you had a bank, like Mr. Heckelman mentioned, where someone else is responsible and all you have to do is write a check. But to set up a bank or set up an in-lieu fee, it's such a significant investment in time and money, it just didn't seem worthwhile.
So how would a proponent know what the cost would be over 5 years or at the end of 5 years?
Well, when you develop I think of it as a menu or an inventory of potential projects, mm-hmm. That would have to include that sort of cost information. And so that's why NEP would have to be so intimately involved.
So are you saying it would be, in this conceptual plan, it would be a predetermined cost, menu item by menu item?
Yes, I think within categories. You know, the cost would depend on size, but you could probably have, like Gene's question about what's a per square meter cost. I think you'd have to have, you know, a menu like that for...
I mean, to sell it to the proponents, you're going to have it.
Right. Yes, you would.
Okay. All right. Okay.
Any other?
Sure, please. Yeah.
I'm not sure that project proponents today know what their costs are going to be or to what extent they know what their costs are going to be, because they have to monitor those that mitigation for 5 years, and they're still responsible. It seems like an outrageous requirement, but...
Okay.
But, Gene, you've worked with these things.
What I like the idea of this menu is as they're monitoring this thing, and they think, well, you know what, this isn't working. Let's go back to the menu and see what else we can do. And so that's the whole idea of this, is having a menu and having somebody saying, hey, we're going to keep an eye on this thing. Let's keep it moving ahead. So.
Okay.
And they probably have much greater possibility of success working with the NEP, which is doing restoration all the time. And you asked about all the projects that have failed. They did fail for quite a few years, some of the even big ones. The planting that the Army Corps did for the dredging of the east side of the west side of the bay 10, 20, 15 years ago, whenever that was, that thing all died out.
No.
Excuse me.
It's coming back now.
It's pretty big.
It's coming back now. But for the immediate time after that, most of those plants had died. And now eelgrass is growing all over the bay for some reason. It's and you can see in some of the maps.
That's okay.
I do think the point about cost is a good one, though, because for everyone involved, cost is an issue. But if the plan were in place and I were, you know, expanding my dock and having to think about these things, I would have to choose, do I just want to take care of the eelgrass business myself or, you know, maybe make use of this plan, and cost would be a factor.
Okay. Dan, you had something?
Yeah, I just want to go back to the bank idea. I'm just thinking maybe between Gene and Eric, the potential projects that are out there now and in the future that you might see. I'm wondering, maybe a bank maybe is not such a bad idea. I mean, I'm not sure where the breaking point is between effective cost-wise and not, because, you know, if you look at, say, the inn at Morro Bay all the way up here with different projects that are possible on the waterfront, maybe it would be cost-effective.
I think probably the NEP, through their research, would say, yes, here's an area for potential growth for a mitigation bank, but we need to have that research done first. And then if we're just talking about the city of Morro Bay, are we excluding the Back Bay?
That's a real interesting idea.
I think what you'd have to do would be to figure out, first determine what size of a bank you would envision, what might be appropriate, and then you'd have to figure out a cost for that, and then kind of go up the waterfront and sort of guesstimate what projects might be coming, because you're going to have to pay for that bank somehow, and the theory is it's amortized over time through these projects that are going to pay into it. Well, is there enough projects to support it? Jack's, I think, looked at that from a maybe not a really high or really low scale view, somewhere in the middle, and determining, it's probably not, based on what he's seen from mitigation banking. He doesn't see any big projects out there that could do it, where, you know, an area like Newport or somewhere else, unless we were doing some big development or several big developments or some other restoration was needed where there was funding coming for it, I don't know where you'd pay for it from.
Yeah, okay. I just, you know, you kind of think of Morro Bay, sleepy little town, but I've seen more development on the waterfront in the last 5 years than I've seen in the last 30 years.
Okay. Jack, thank you.
Yep.
And as a marketing tool, as a future marketing tool, because there's no free lunch, we would invite Anchor Keyway to draft a letter to the city describing the recommended process moving forward, and where in that process Anchor QEA could best participate. My thinking is that you're the expert. You know vastly more than any of us do about this, and that letter could be used perhaps to advantage in drafting an appropriate RFP for a next step.
I'd be happy to.
Excuse me?
I said I'd be happy to.
Delighted. Yeah, delighted. Eric?
No, I have nothing more. I think I saw this as a Q&A, and then Lynn, I'll get the rest of your comments, and anybody else, if you got any other comments from any other board members, send them to me, and then I'll forward those off to Jack, and then he can finalize this document, and I'm sure that'll be an attachment to the letter.
Okay. Jack, thank you. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
This was fascinating, actually.
On that, I'm always happy to talk about eelgrass and yeah. and come to Morro Bay.
Okay. And, right. And you come from where to Morro
Ventura.
Bay? Ventura. Sorry?
Ventura.
Oh, okay. Well, so that's not terrible.
No.
Thank you.
But neither is Morro Bay.
Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Okay, so that brings us to C2. C2, and I haven't called for, actually, and after that, I should call for public comment.
Yeah,
you're right. Thank you very much at C1. Thank you so much, Lori. Thanks for keeping track. Is there any public comment regarding C3 that we just had? Seeing none, we'll move on to C1, which is update from the Marine Services Facility Boatyard Ad Hoc Committee. Dana?
I don't have anything really to report, but I think there was a question by Board Member Lynn Meissen regarding the RFP.
Yes, in view of some the new fact that Joe's Yard is going to close, I believe, soon, and he did put a number of boats through there. In fact, he's been busier than he's ever been, I think, the last few months, everybody trying to get their haul out done before he closes. And the fact that Port St. Louis Boatyard has a waiting list with some 8 or 10 boats on it. And I know I just hauled out that down there, but he just found me a spot and pulled me out because he knew I wanted to get right back in and I wouldn't linger. So with those two things, would they have any effect on the findings or the ideas and what's going to happen with our boatyard? It should be increase the demand.
Well, I'm sure it would, but maybe Eric can respond to the RFP end of it as far as language concerning when they get around to the RFP is getting someone is finding somebody to do the feasibility study. When they do their feasibility study,
yes.
They should be looking at all aspects.
By definition.
Yeah.
So those two facts would be hopefully included and let them know about them.
Yeah, if they do their job right and they look at the market and everything. You know, that when I started talking, we decided to put this off till this item. You know, we've got that market analysis that LWC did as a tool that whoever does this financial feasibility can use in their toolbox to help their work. Obviously, that was on the that market analysis was done with the Myers Boatyard in place and Port St. Louis operating the way it was, and it was a little bit of a different world back then in both counts. Obviously, with the yard here now closing, so. That will, like I say, if our consultant is doing their job, they should recognize pretty quickly and go to Port St. Louis and see what's going on there and know that our boatyard by then will probably be closed by the time we actually get somebody under contract. So.
Okay.
And we won't let them get away without that information.
I guess that's my real concern.
Okay. Anything else on this agenda item? No? Okay. So we'll move on to C2. Any public comment on C2, which is an update from the Finance and Budget Ad Hoc Committee? Seeing none, the committee has nothing to report at this time. C3, we've taken care of already. C4, update from the Marine Sanctuary Ad Hoc Committee. That committee has nothing to report, and given that there is not likely to be anything for a while, what I would like to propose to the board is that we keep the committee intact, but we remove this from the from ongoing agendas until something occurs.
That's fine.
Is that okay? Okay. Okay. So we're in agreement. We're in agreement. So the committee will remain in place on standby. So then C5 is update from the Working Waterfront Ad Hoc Committee.
I'm going to suggest that we just put this in the same envelope.
I totally agree because it's LCPGP, and supposedly that's happening. And if they want something, they've told us that they would keep us informed or ask us questions. So, okay. And then that brings us to C6, which is an oral update on status of various waterfront lease site projects and negotiations, lease site management activities, and Harbor Department capital projects. Bill, I would invite you to come to the podium, and you had two things you were interested in. If you could very briefly restate those for us so we make sure we cover them this evening if we can.
Thank you. Bill Martini again. Primarily it had to do with the lease sites at the southern end, which would have been lease site 34W. And I know on the staff report it called that lease site a wharf. It may have been a typo, or it could have been referring to all three lease sites because 35 and 36W are not on the agenda. But as primarily that lease site is coming up in December, and so I was just seeing if it was going out for RFP or what the status was on that, and also on 35 and 36W. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Eric?
Sure, thank you. So these, to Mr. Martini, these things go from south to north, so we'll be starting in that direction. So I've, what I propose to do here, if this is okay with the board, I'll just go through these individually. See if there's any questions, comments, go through each one, and we'll move on and keep them flowing that direction. So 34W, the wharf, it's the wharf because that's what the current lessee calls it. It's not because it's a wharf. That's just what he's got a name on it for, and that's just what we call that lease because it's really just a single person that owns a set of about four slips. So that site was directed by City Council last year sometime to go out to RFP, which is Request for Proposals, public bid, basically, along with 3536, which is the empty lease site immediately to its north. Just due to workload and other things on my plate, I just haven't gotten that RFP together and gotten it to the City Council for approval to let out. I'm hoping to get that sometime out in the next 30 to 60 days, but with everything else going on, it's just one more thing to do. So that's the status on that one. 34W is, like I said, it's about four slips. Very small, limited access through the property immediately adjacent that Mr. Martini owns. It's parked across the street on a different, separate set of property. So it's a very interesting little tiny lease site. So that's the update on that one. Any questions on that? Gene?
Was there a waterfront lease site inspection done on that site?
There was on that. So after 12, we required all of our leaseholders to produce a report, an inspection report. Basically, all our leases say every at periodic times. It doesn't specify a time. Periodically, all lessees shall inspect their bulkheads, seawalls, and other water improvements for maintenance and repair needs. And so, coming out of our seawall experience that we had at the boatyard, not the Myers boatyard, but the boatyard site next to the Otter Rock Cafe, that partially failing seawall there, we required all of our lessees that had that in their leases to give us a report, which we did. Some of them didn't have it in their leases. There's not very many, but a couple of them didn't. The vast majority of them did. They produced reports. Many of them have done the repairs that were already outlined in there. Some of them had repairs that were recommended to be done over time, and so we've been trying to follow up on those and make sure that those projects are getting done. But, yes, one was done on lease site 34W and had a number of recommendations.
Eric, before you leave that one, did I just hear understand you to say that the inspection of improvements is periodic as opposed to every 5 years?
We, as a city, as a landlord, per our lease management policy, it is our intent to inspect all of our lease sites, have our lease sites inspected every 5 years. All of our leases, the vast majority of our leases have a stipulation in them that says the leaseholder shall periodically inspect the water improvements
two different items.
So the five-year one is ours. The other one, it just says periodic. It doesn't, it, unfortunately, our lease language doesn't stipulate any sort of a timeline. It just says periodically, and it's sort of an unconditioned sort of thing. And when we had the seawall failure at the boatyard lease site, looking back in our records, it had been, well, actually we could really find no record to where we had asked our leaseholders to have done that. So we said, well, it's hasn't been done in forever. Let's do it. And so that's when we did it.
So, and I know I'm sort of skipping down here to the stat, to a, one of the last items on your staff report, but we're on the topic now. So the harbor lease management policy, which was adopted in October of 2001, has that, as it relates to this maintenance of improvements point, has that been updated since that time? Has it changed in any way?
No.
Okay. So the as you just pointed out to us, the policy says that the city shall contract to have the lease sites inspected and a report made on such inspections every 5 years. No, that's what it says. That's the policy. Okay. The city shall contract to have the lease sites inspected and a report made on such inspections every 5 years. And so do I understand that it is the case that some of the lease contracts for these properties don't have a mirrored provision to that as it relates to the leaseholder doing something every 5 years, but rather, quote, periodically, unquote?
I'm a little confused. And when I say all of the leases, there may be an outlier or two on language because we've still got some old Pipkin 1968 leases and a couple old counties, so there's a couple of outliers. But when I say all leases, it's the vast majority. All of our leases have a requirement in them that the tenants maintain their improvements. And that's a whole cloth across the board. Thou shalt maintain them to typical standards. It doesn't stipulate when you need to look at things. It doesn't say you have to inspect them. It doesn't say you have to do anything. It just says you got to maintain them. We go in, per our lease management policy, every 5 years according to the policy and double check on them and make sure that they're keeping up on things. Historically, in the past, what we have used to do those inspections has been our fire department. We've used, the last one we did was a firefighter who was on limited duty because he had an injury, and so we used him to come in and do our lease site inspections. And before that, it was another firefighter. I don't know if he was a light duty firefighter, but we used our fire department, and they looked primarily at life safety, fire code type stuff, although they did inspect the lease site overall for maintenance and repair. And so that's what we've historically used. Our leases...
Isn't it the case that in some of those sites that improvements, quote unquote, involve overwater structure, in-water structure, on-land structure, and improvements to include the revetments and piling and foundation and framing and...
And all of the above.
And all of the above.
And more.
And yeah, thank you. And,
yes, there
and more.
Many of them are quite complicated in that regard. Some of them buildings are all on land and pretty straightforward. Some of them buildings are overhanging the water and not so straightforward.
It's my understanding, because you've told us this not so terribly long ago, that the city is working to update its harbor lease management policy.
Yeah, that's one of the items I'll be talking about in a little bit, yes.
Sure. And is there, before I let this go, is there an intention on the part of the city to address this inspection, if I use the word advisedly, of improvements on lease sites? Is there going to be something a little different?
In the lease policy, at least as far as the lease policy goes, it is my intent to take both the periodic five-year maintenance lease site inspection that we do, the one that I just explained that we've had our firefighters do, and update that and write up a policy within the policy. As you stated, it's probably a one or two liner in there now that just says the city shall every 5 years conduct lease site inspections for maintenance and repair issues. I believe that should be more of a policy that really out, and maybe we can write a policy that's attached to our lease management policy or some sort of a binder or whatever you want to call it. Something that explains a little more what the procedure is, what the policy and procedure is, because, as I've said, we've used the fire department in the past. Ideally, we ought to be using some sort of a commercial building inspector or some outside service to do it. It comes down to money. That ain't cheap to do. And that's, we've got 30-some-odd lease sites, and that's a lot of inspection, that's a lot of follow-up, and, you know, if you've been in my office, and I'm not just crying on your shoulder trying to get sympathy, we're overloaded with stuff to do and overwhelmed, and taking on another big project like that, and it would be great if we could do better lease site oversight. Absolutely. We've had things that have slipped, things that have gone by. Folks have let things go in some cases, and we've not policed it as well as we could.
Yeah,
I'd love to do better.
I understand, and I'm sympathetic to the challenge. And I'm also aware that the present language, and this is my opinion, I'm not an attorney, I don't want to be an attorney, I'm not pretending to be an attorney, that the existing language, in my personal opinion and in my professional opinion as a marine surveyor, that does these kinds of inspections, that the city has opened itself up to some liability.
In the policy or in our lease site language?
In the policy, the city shall contract to have the lease sites inspected and a report made on such inspections every 5 years, and the title of it is maintenance of improvements. And improvements, as you pointed out to me,
really is everything.
Is everything. That's right. So
I don't disagree with that.
So I'm hopeful that in its process of considering an update of its harbor lease management policy, that the city would look very, very seriously at this aspect.
Yeah. I absolutely intend to look at that part of it in the audit part, too, and develop some sub-policy underneath the one line that says we shall audit every 5 years. We need policy and procedure and written into that so we've got consistency and enforceability of it. And you're absolutely right on the maintenance part, too.
Then council can decide whether it's – whether the money's worth the squeeze, you know? So, okay, I've interrupted you. So, Gene?
Yes, concerning lease site inspections, the city, and I'm not sure what the policy was, but recently, within a year, that this every lease site had to come up with a waterfront inspection on the water side of their leases. I don't know whether that was the periodic thing there that the city insisted on them doing them or whatever it was. But it's been done, though, in defense of the Harbor Department. They got it done.
Well, and that's what I spoke to earlier about where our leases have in them. Our lessees have the responsibility to periodically inspect the water improvements. But the leases didn't stipulate a time period. And when we had the failure at the boatyard lease site, we had pause for concern and started looking at other leases and realized that nobody had really done this in forever other than when, you know, like maybe the Anderson Inn when the place rebuilt, and of course they went through and had full engineering done and something like that had occurred. We hadn't required any inspections, so we basically went to our leaseholders and said, hey, if you've had an inspection done of your water improvements in the last, I think we put 10 years on there, show us. Otherwise, you need to produce something in the next 4 or 6 months, and those are the ones you're talking about, Gene, that got done.
And that... and I haven't gotten an update. I haven't asked for an update about that. I mean, you made that clear to me some time ago that was happening. Is it done? Are all of the relevant lease sites have all the relevant lease sites completed that?
Yeah, the lease sites completed their inspections.
Thank you, Gene. I appreciate that. It's the conundrum of the policy that really has got my attention. Okay, please.
Okay, so we covered 34, 35, 36, 37, the next one north. The actual boatyard, the Myers property there, immediately north of where the old wharf was, where the cannery was, That lease is on a holdover. It's expired. I believe it expired in 16. The owner, I've been back and forth with the owner whether or not they want to redo the boatyard. The council's direction on that was that boatyard is going to have to come into modern-day environmental compliance because it never really built. I mean, it was built a long, long time ago and wasn't built with any modern standards as far as environmental capture of pollutants and compliance. And so the city's desire was if they wanted to continue operating that boatyard that they had to bring it into compliance and get a Regional Water Quality Control Board NPDES permit, et cetera, et cetera. Those owners went back and forth for quite a while trying to figure out what it meant to what it would take to do that. Obviously, as indicated now in the recent news that they're shutting down, they've elected to not operate that boatyard anymore, so they'll be closing that down. So now this one's going to be another work in progress and start negotiating with them and what they want to do in the future and how to operate that. I'm assuming, I'm not assuming, I know they want to still continue operating those slips, so they'll keep operating just the slips and I'm assuming pull out the boatyard and clear that space out down there. Any questions on that one? Okay, moving a little further north, lease site 62W, which is Kayak Horizons. It's expiring the end of September. We've council direction on that one a while back was to put it out to bid, public bid RFP. We just put that out here maybe a month and a half ago. Public bid that is expiring in September, and we won't have the RFPs evaluated and awarded, and anybody's got a project. It'll take, you know, a fair amount of time, you know, at least probably 8 to 12 months to get through a permitting process at a very minimum. We're on a short-term lease with Dennis Kruger there at Kayak Horizons. He's going to keep operating that for another year. So we're going to put him on a short-term one-year holdover as we evaluate those proposals, whatever we get for redoing that lease site. And then whoever wins the RFP, whatever their project is, we'll issue a consent of landowner for them to do whatever their project is. They'll go through the planning and permitting process through the Planning Commission and City Council to get concept approval. And once they get concept approval of the plan, then we can negotiate a new lease, which is probably going to be at least a year down the line. So that's the reason for keeping Dennis in place there for a year, so that we've got continuity there. Any questions there? Okay. Next one, next door, 6364, which is the Gray's Inn. Josephine Gray sold that lease site to a young couple, Todd and Tamara Baston. A couple of years ago, they had a proposal to, as that lease was expiring, or moving towards expiring, it's an old Pipkin lease, they had a proposal to do a modest redevelopment there. They're not going to tear anything down. The building stays. They'll build the walkway out in the back. They got concept level approval for that. The harbor walk on the back side. They're doing some ADA and other improvements in the front. They're doing some parking improvements on the parking that they have up in the front end of that place. And then I think a little longer down the line, maybe they'll do something with the slip. So that one is another one on my plate to negotiate. It's basically negotiation underway or preparing to get underway to negotiate with them a new lease for longer term for them to operate. Any questions there?
With new lease negotiations, I mean, this, as I understand it, the city's pricing policy currently is, quote, appraised value, unquote, whatever that might mean. I mean, whatever that results in, and 8% thereof. Is there any intention on the part of the city to reevaluate that rate?
That would logically be a part of the lease management policy. We're going to be looking at all aspects of the lease management policy, and rental rates certainly will be one of them. As far as looking at, so you're right, it's 8% of the appraised value of the underlying property, which is basically the dirt. It's a sort of a strange appraisal because it's not your typical fee-owned property. There's appraisers that it's a little bit of a specialty. Not every real estate appraiser can do it, but it is the appraised value of the property, and you take 8% of that, and that's the base rent, and then you apply the percentage rents to it, and you come up with an overall rent. So I'm sure the rent, our basic rent structures are going to be part of that lease management policy because that's where that lives.
Well, the part of it about the land appraisal being the basis for it, you know, that's, I understand. I mean, that's embedded in
in the Tidelands grant, in the state's Tidelands grant legislation, Chapter 17.6, but there's nothing in there about what the applied rate would be.
No, correct.
And there are, I'm just being conversational, not argumentative, and there are a variety of rates in other waterfront municipalities mm-hmm. up and down the coast. So I would invite the city to consider that many of those properties are location, 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 as my realtor keeps telling me is how I want to live my real estate life. And there's a lot of traffic the last couple of years on the waterfront, and it's increasing. I mean, it's a weekday these days is like a weekend a few years ago. So that's a valuable, potentially very valuable commodity, and I would encourage the city to look ahead relative to the value of that commodity.
Our
especially given that we have $2+ million worth of unfunded liability for our waterfront, the city's portion of the waterfront.
Yes, as you correctly state, our Tidelands grant statutory mandate as to manage this property for the state is basically that we manage it and enhance it and develop it for those things in the Coastal Act. But from a property and management money making standpoint, we're to charge fair market rent and, you know, maximize our revenues to the extent possible. It doesn't stipulate numbers or percents or anything. It leaves it up to the municipalities to do that. Anything else? Anybody on that one? Gray's Inn, 6970, Morro Bay Aquarium, another Pipkin lease, penned in 1968. It expires the end of this September. I'll back up a little bit historically. Starting about 5 years ago, we went to the leaseholder to see what their plan for the future was. They wanted to continue operating essentially the way they were. City Council elected to not go with that future and wanted to put it out to bid and change the way it was operating. We put it out to bid. We had one interested party in that process. Was the Avila Aquarium folks. Initially, they changed their name to Central Coast Aquarium. Even though they did not, nobody applied to the RFP document itself within the document deadline, but Central Coast Aquarium continued to remain interested, came back to the City Council several times with their project and what their proposal was. The Council issued a consent of landowner document for them to move forward with. I think all the dates in that consent of landowner document have since expired. Central Coast Aquarium is still at the table. They've got a tentative United States Department of Agriculture, USDA, $20 million grant approval. It requires a number of studies and other documents be produced, about $130,000 of the documents, I believe. The first big one is a financial feasibility study that's somewhere between $30,000 and $40,000. Much like our boatyard project, financial feasibility is the logical next step to see if that project can move forward. So Central Coast Aquarium is trying to figure out how to raise the funding to do that. They had, like I said, we'd put a consent to landowner approval with them, and they were supposed to move forward with that. They weren't able to do that over the last 3 or 4 years. But they've got new directorship, and we're working with the Christine Johnson, who's the new director there, to see if they're going to be able to put together that financial feasibility to see where that will go. So it's we're very much a work in progress, a long way to go on it. We're at least the plan today, and it could change depending on how things develop with Central Coast Aquarium as it's come September after the lease expires with the Tylers, is to go into an interim short-term lease with Central Coast Aquarium for them to operate on site, and then as they work through financial feasibility and the rest of all the studies they need to try and get funded.
I'm sure
there's going to be questions on this one.
At what rate?
It's to be determined. Haven't even negotiated that yet.
Well, before I start, let's... Jean? On this one? Owen? Lynn?
Yep.
Dana?
Did I hear you say that they were going to take over that lease right away and then find out how they were going to afford it?
It's not. I would say everything is under negotiation at this point. You know, we had planned on moving forward with them. They had some, they went through a pretty significant management change with their executive director, and they lost a lot of time in that process. So unfortunately, we're behind the eight ball very much now because the Tylers are, at least with them, is expiring the end of September.
Okay. So I was just thinking about that and seeing the possible empty lease site on the water that the city has. Is there a way for the city to use that and temporarily until you actually have a tenant for sure? Or just curious.
I guess anything is up for consideration. Couldn't the city use it? Could we rent it out for something? I suppose. I don't know anything that the city, meaning myself and my department in the city or anybody else, can use it for.
They have a permit to use the water, right, for the aquarium. If the lease lapses, then does that permit go away?
There is no permit there. There hasn't been for probably decades. That was when we were first considering what direction to go before we even decided which direction to go with to put it out to bid. One of the beck and cries from the public was, don't lose that water permit. Don't lose that water permit. And we looked into it, and it turns out there is no water permit. The Central Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board has a NPDES permit, a national non-point, whatever that thing is, for discharging and water and pollutants. They have a permit that has a number of aquariums and aquarium-type facilities on it and a blanket permit that cover a bunch of them, and the Morro Bay Aquarium ain't one of them. So they have no permit. I think inquiries to the Water Board have been along the lines that it's such a small operation and such a small scale that it's just not on their radar screen.
So if the Central Coast Aquarium takes it over, they can just continue under the current terms?
Understanding that it's speculation as opposed to fact, based upon properties along the waterfront, lease sites along the waterfront that are of similar size, could you offer a speculation on what, if it was 8% of appraised value, what the annual rent might be?
I just happen to have that exact information. I wouldn't be speculation at all. So based on relatively recent nearby-ish appraisals from the per square foot dollar area for land and water, so there's an appraised value that typically comes out for the land leases and then for the water leases, which started about the top of the Redmond on down. The water lease is usually half of the land lease. Based on the existing square footage of the Morro Bay Aquarium, not including the street end, which is what we also put out to bid for potential build, include what Central Coast Aquarium had proposed to build on, but not including that square footage, just the existing lease site under existing appraisal rates, which are about $57 per square foot for land and $28.5 for water, comes to just shy of $24,000 per year as a base rent at 8%.
Okay, thank you. And do I recall that in 2015, when the city issued its consent to landowner provisional to the CCA, Central Coast Aquarium, for that site, that it was proposed to be $1 a year?
I don't have the consent of landowner in front of me, but I don't recall the consent of landowner saying anything about a rental rate, because at that point that there was no rental to be had. It was just permission for CCA to apply to the Community Development Department for all the plans to start going through the permitting process. So, and as I spoke earlier on, I forget which lease site, we don't negotiate a lease until after they get concept level approval, and it would take them quite a while to get through that. A dollar a year was what was floated out pretty early on when CCA came to the table and they said, we're interested. And they said, we believe, you know, we've done our own financial analysis, and they proposed a dollar a year. And at that time, city administration had taken that and said, okay, and that's what we move forward with, and that's what we were proposing to the council when we approved that consent to landowner in a conceptual way in terms of what we thought the rent was going to be. But always up to negotiation.
And my recollection is that's what council responded to.
What do you mean responded?
The concept of a dollar a year.
Yes, but that was also the council 4 years ago?
2015.
Yeah.
And repeated again in 2016.
But still, that's would be to be negotiated.
Okay, and so to restate something that you already made clear to us, Chapter 17.6 of state law requires that those lands be rented out at fair market. I hope the city is paying attention to that. You mentioned the financial feasibility study, which is a necessary element of the application process for the grant that CCA is pursuing. And you mentioned $30,000 to $40,000, which CCA says is correct, and 40 is the number that they are using. And if I recall, the city of Morro Bay and the council approved a $10,000 gift of taxpayer money to the CCA in 2015 to use toward, conditional, to use toward that financial feasibility study. And at that time, CCA said it had $10,000 and that it would raise the other 20. To my knowledge, that hasn't happened yet. As recently as a couple of months ago, CCA said that it still had the $10,000 of Morro Bay taxpayer money and that they had 14 of their own. So as of a couple of months ago, they had 24 of the proposed 40 after 3 years. I also took the time to look at the public record or the financial records of CCA, and I can share with you that in 2013, that organization lost $105,000. In 2014, it lost $81,000 on $321,000 worth of revenue, reported revenue. In 2015, it lost $70,500 on a reported revenue of $367,000. So revenue was going up. That's a good thing. In 2016, they lost $56,500 on revenue of $423,000. So my point being that I'm hopeful that the city would apply the same financial responsibility to that lease site that they would hopefully apply to any other lease site on the waterfront. Also, it might be worthwhile to mention that according to CCA a couple of months ago, that the application process for the grant that they would like to obtain from the USDA would be, this is them talking, approximately a two-year process, if not a bit longer. The point of that being, that's their business, the point of that being that lease site lease site 6970 and 69W70W, insofar as the Central Coast Aquarium is concerned, as a fair market entity, is at least 2 years away from being able to pay for that site at fair market. So I think my personal opinion is, and I'm taking advantage of my position sitting here tonight with a microphone, that I think the city's got a challenge relative to that lease site, those lease sites. And I hope it pays some attention to it, because that's valuable property down there. I love aquariums. I'm all for aquariums. $2+ million worth of unfunded liability for the waterfront that the city owns presently, and the number's going up all the time. We've got to make some money off of those sites. Not only that, they're obligated to do so according to state law. I'll get it down off my soapbox. Thank you.
Okay, any other questions on aquarium? Okay, moving right along. Next one on the list, 86W, Libertine Pub, right down there below Centennial Stairway, Centennial Parkway. The owner of that site had put in a joint proposal with another developer and to the RFP that we had put out to the next-door neighbor site off the hook a couple of years ago to jointly put those two sites together. We had a consent of landowner. We have a consent of landowner issued for that site initially. I guess I should back up even further. We went to that leaseholder about 5 years ago and asked if he had intention to continue on or redevelop it. He did. The city council went with his plan. His original plan was to scrape it to the ground and build a new one-story brew pub, keeping the Libertine theme in there, Libertine Pub theme in there, have a little bit of food, but mostly alcohol and brewing, and then a little upstairs deck, view deck for people to go up onto, some nice, where they have parking now. Four substandard parking places would be outdoor promenade type area. So he was going to move forward with that. Then the RFP project came along for off the hook. He proposed to go in both sites with that. So that took a fair amount of time for that process to unwind. He was not awarded that site with his fellow developer, John King. Started to pursue the original project. Decided with some encouragement from the city to keep the existing building and keep it two stories and convert the upstairs to hotel and do the brew pub thing on the downstairs. So the city went to the city council with that, issued a new consent of landowner on that. Subsequently, in the time being, now the Market Plaza property across the street and on the hill where D'Estacio's is and the parking lot has gotten out to being marketed, and he's interested in that project as well with another developer and possibly tying the Libertine property together. So we're kind of waiting to see how that Market Plaza project plays out. His lease expires the end of September. Went to the council a bit a while ago in closed session, and it's still a work in progress under negotiation what direction we're going with him, but probably be sticking with him for a little while until we find out what happens with Market Plaza and see if he's going to be applying there. Questions?
At what rate?
You would ask me that.
Well, I don't know. I accept I don't know. I mean,
it's.
And you may be constrained from discussing.
No, I'm not. Well, it's not going to be at the Pipkin rate. It should be at fair market.
And that's actually what I should have said. Is it going to be at the Pipkin rate?
Yeah, no. The Pipkin rate was a rate set in '68, and then it got reappraised once in 1993, and so for a year it was sort of market, but then obviously it's dropped behind. It's just been CPI adjustments, and then so it's under negotiation, but it's not going to be the Pipkin rate.
Thank you.
Any other questions on Libertine? Okay, next door, 8788, formerly Off the Hook Restaurant. on an interim lease now. So I explained to you that that went out to public bid. We had three entities apply. The joint project from the Libertine folks next door, the existing leaseholder who had fairly recently taken over from a foreclosure from Violet League, and then Sharice Hansen and her husband, the young couple in the front and under the Sea Gallery, all put in proposals. City Council eventually went with TLC, Sharice Hansen and her husband, Travis League, with their proposal, issued a consent of landowner for them to apply. They had to have gotten their full plans and specs into community development for the regular permitting process begin to start back in January this year. They did that. They're going to Planning Commission, I believe, at the next meeting, some mid-August, either the first or second meeting in August. I can't remember which one. Okay, August 21st, Lori's telling me. So they're slated for Planning Commission. They've got some pretty tight timeline, time triggers they got to meet to perform to stay within compliance of their consent to landowner. So it's really going to see how things go at Planning Commission on the 21st. They had taken their initial concept plans, and it had been run through community development, not through Planning Commission, but it got a pretty thorough community development review when we were evaluating all the proposals when all three were still on the table, because they all had inconsistencies with the general plan, local coastal plan, so we sent them all three back to the drawing board, so they all had some corrections. So TLC hit the ground somewhat running in January because they already had some of the major corrections made. Their project as proposed was pretty well compliant when they applied for it, so hopefully they won't have too much trouble on the 21st getting through Planning Commission. Once they get Planning Commission concept level approval, then they've got to negotiate a lease in pretty short order, because at that point we'll be able to negotiate a lease and produce more robust financial proof that they can build and maintain and run the project financially. And assuming they continue to meet all those obligations, eventually that place will get demolished and get under construction. Most folks don't like to do construction in the summertime for a lot of obvious reasons. So assuming they continue to perform, I don't know that they would get under construction this winter, just due to the timing of it. It'd probably most likely be the following winter, because, like I said, most people don't want to get under construction in the summertime. It's just too disruptive. So that's what's going on there. Any questions?
I had a citizen ask me a couple of weeks ago, given that there's a for lease sign up on the front of the building, or I should say the Embarcadero side of the building, asked me whether rent was being paid currently by somebody. Can you answer that for them?
Yes. Yeah, that's public information. They're paying. They're on an interim lease. Pretty short term, they're paying $3,000 a month there. Which is, if you amortize that out over 12 months, is a little bit more than what we were making off the previous leaseholder rent standpoint.
That's going to be my next question.
And you're right, there's a banner up there, so they've basically got all the retail space filled. The restaurant space in the back was pretty stripped clean. And a lot of non-restaurant and other siding, and the place was left a mess. The previous leaseholder that left there tore a lot of stuff out, and the place is pretty uninhabitable. So Sharice and Travis have been trying to get it fixed back up and lease it out, including the upstairs. There's some upstairs space. It was kind of built to be an apartment or a transient occupancy. It was a sort of an illegal apartment building for a while. But it's a little tough of a place to, maybe an office, but the zoning down there is so tight, you can't just have any office down there. It's got to be coastal dependent and fit the zoning, which is tough. So they're trying to get anybody in there. I know the banner out front says all uses welcome or all something welcome. Well, it's got to be in compliance with the zoning. Anything and anything can't just go in there. It's got to match the zoning, which unfortunately is pretty restrictive. So that's what's going on there. Any other questions? 89W, the boatyard. I've spoke a fair amount about the failing seawall there. Seawall partially collapsed in 2015. We've been negotiating with the owner there for an awful lot. Been back and forth to council. We've got new leases in place. Got amended leases in place. We've gone back and forth many, many times trying to avoid a lawsuit there. That site was redeveloped in the mid-90s, early to mid-90s, completely scraped, rebuilt. Something went wrong with the seawall rebuild there. Whose fault it is yet to be determined, but we've been mitigating and negotiating with the owner there to try and settle out a claim. And so far, we've remained out of court. A fair amount of mitigation to stay that way. Still believe we've got a good project. Basically, the leaseholder is going to go in and rebuild that whole seawall, including adding a fair amount of rock revetment that isn't there anymore, put in new docks. Coastal Commission has made them on the southern building. The walkway around the backside, the harbor walk, is only 8 feet wide. As we know, the City and Coastal Commission is requiring everybody to go 10 feet now. So when they went to Coastal for basically waivers to repair an existing seawall, Coastal said, well, we want your walkway to be 10 feet now. So they're now having to shuck and jive and make that walkway 10 feet. That was the last reason we went back into negotiation and did another amendment to the lease, was because Coastal did that, which was a pretty major development. And so we're still intact there and still on track to keep that lease going and get that seawall under repair, hopefully this winter, which is the time, as I spoke on the off-hook site, to do redevelopment. So try and minimize the impacts there. So hopefully that'll keep going, knock on wood. In conjunction with that site, Otter Rock Cafe next door, that site has been for sale for a number of years. The boatyard leaseholder is working on buying that site and doing a pretty major remodel to the Otter Rock Cafe building and bringing in a new operator, redoing the docks there as well, or the one dock there in front. Pretty significant remodel on the inside. Redo the restrooms, the trash dumpsters inside the restaurant for some bizarre reason, and so that'll move outside, and hopefully that'll get underway sometime this fall as well. So we're working with the same leaseholder as the boatyard. He's buying it and taking over there, and so we've been working with him over the last year as well to try and come up with an overall package, because the Otter Rock Cafe has got some pretty significant structural and other maintenance deficiencies that have been let go over the years, and so the boatyard owner is coming in and correcting all those as part of this package to get a new lease and keep moving there, get another long-term lease there. Any questions? The cafe there, which has kind of got a sort of a cloth. It was originally an outdoor cafe, just with sort of some sunshades, and then the existing leaseholder put in sort of a semi-enclosed cloth ceiling on it that probably when it was new worked pretty well, but now I don't think keeps out the water very well, so it's pretty well deteriorated. So that's going to get a real roof on it. And then that little notch that's in it where the gangway was originally going to go down comes out, and then they'll fill it out. So it should be a much more enclosed and nicer restaurant once they're done with it.
When the dust settles on 89 and 89W, can we assume that the rent will be significantly modified?
The rent is reduced, currently reduced, and stays that way for about 10 years to mitigate for that. So that's what we've been negotiating with the council and that leaseholder for the last 5 years, is of an overall package that keeps everybody out of court and keeps everybody happy and gets that wall fixed and keeps that site operating. Any other questions on that one? So that's 89 and 90. 102W, Giovanni, Central Coast Seafoods, another Pipkin lease expiring in September 2018. I've got previous council direction on that one to work with Giovanni de Garamore and negotiate a new lease there. That one's an oddball one in that although there's a pretty good chunk of land that's part of that lease, cuts through about half of Giovanni's fish market building itself. We don't own all the property there. That is one of the few exceptions on the waterfront where on the west side of Embarcadero, we don't own Giovanni's parking lot and the coffee pot restaurant and the T-shirt shop down below. That's all privately owned property. That was before the war. That was actually dry land. So after the existing landowners kept that land, and so council said negotiate with the existing landowner because obviously it's a fee owned there, and he had all the access. So that's what we're doing on that site. And that's another work in progress. Probably going to end up going on a holdover because I doubt I'll have a lease negotiated by the end of September. So, and he's, as you know, those slips were put in maybe 3 or 4 years ago now. So that was sort of the last real development that could be done into there. The parking lot area, although there's a lot of open space, it is required parking for those slips and the other projects, although the other improvements they've done in there. So I don't think they could take up parking space and do anything different to fill in with building and do anything more with. So there won't be, at least I don't anticipate, a lot of redevelopment. I don't know if Giovanni intends to rebuild that building or not, or redo it. So far he hasn't indicated he has. I think it's going to stay put. Questions on that one? Ron, you look like you have a question. It's coming.
Well, no, I was just thinking about the site, and I was thinking about the fact that that deck, if you will, it's not actually a deck. It's a wharf, I guess, in front of where the serving tables are. That's treated timbers or something. I mean, they're massive. Are there ever, and that's not the only one. There's another one. Dutchman's has a similar situation. Has there ever been any, heaven forbid, health department issues with any of those sites?
Because of the treated timber.
Yeah, and they're porous, and you know.
Not that I'm aware. Same thing. Toxins dioxide too.
Yeah,
it's built on a wharf, a heavily treated timber wharf.
Yeah.
I don't think at Dutchman's there's.
No,
that's just the pier. It's slime eel. It's a hagfish operation going off the pier.
No, where he has his outdoor tables is heavy timber.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. Not that I'm aware of.
Okay,
on to lease site 140, United States Coast Guard. You will see them come into the city council meeting on the 14th of August, a couple of weeks. So I'll back up on a little history there. Coast Guard has for decades now been working with the city to try and get a bigger, more efficient building. That building was built in the early 90s to serve two 87-foot cutters as more of an administrative base than anything. It was never built for overnight accommodation and male-female separate accommodation. It was built for an entirely different station. In fact, it wasn't even Station Morro Bay back then. It was just servicing the two 87-footers. They since changed to a search and rescue detachment and eventually became a full station that they are now with the cutters, with overnight crews, the 47s during hazardous bar times. When they go out during haz bar or inclement weather operations, they've got to have two boats, which means they've got to have two crews. They can't house two crews, male and female, in there, so it's the only small boat station in the nation that I understand. Can't have females, doesn't have females, so they want to correct that. So we've been working with them trying to, we had joint projects with a new harbor office, joint Coast Guard complex. Those never went anywhere. Coast Guard, about 2013, came to us and said, we've got about $1.5 million to build us a couple thousand more square feet. Where can we build it? We worked with them for a long time. As you know, we came to the Harbor Advisory Board a couple of times. They were looking at different locations. They ultimately landed. They wanted our office building, the Harbor Office building. or the right next door where the public restroom is between us and Krill's. They had their eyeball on that. They really wanted our office building because they wanted their building to be together. We said, okay, well, that could work, but we don't have money to build a new Harbor office. Can you pay fair market rent for your building? Because they pay $1 a year now for the existing Coast Guard Station building. We went back and forth with them for a period of about a year and a half. Unfortunately, commands change with the Coast Guard, and priorities change, and sometimes it's important, sometimes it's not. So a lot of time has elapsed during this whole process. So far, the Coast Guard hasn't been able to pay, at least come up with paying anything more than $1 a year, and we've said, well, we can't move then. Their funding runs out the end of, at least they've got to have it obligated in federal fiscal 19, which is it's right now, or coming up. I guess, is that coming up in October? No, that's right now. This October, that fiscal year expires, so they're scrambling. They don't want to lose the funding, so they came back to us with a couple of the proposals to build back just into the parking lot adjacent to their building. So that's what we're bringing to the City Council on the 14th is consideration of that proposal. And so they're still interested in building the larger project. If you were to build their station today to their needs, to the specs that the Coast Guard would build, if you had a blank slate, it would be about three times as large as it is now. So they're trying to get some relief to at least be able to accommodate two crews, because right now they've when they've got their crews in there, they've got people sleeping on couches and cots and on the floor, and it's just they're doing great duty, but they're being asked an awful lot of. So they're trying to get a little more space, so we'll bring that to the City Council. And assuming the City Council issues a consent to landowner, they'll then apply to community development to get all the plans approved. They'll have to get the plans through the city plans to get building plans, get concept approval, and then precise plan approval. They don't have to go to Coastal Commission because they're federal, as a superior authority to the state. So they're lucky that they don't have to go to Coastal. But they do have to go through the NEPA process, the National Environmental Policy Act, which is the equivalent to the California Environmental Quality Act, CEQA. So they do have to get basically concurrence with Coastal that Coastal would permit it, if Coastal would be asked for a permit. So they've got to meet the standard. They just don't have to get the actual permit. So that's where hopefully the Coast Guard will be going here in the near future.
Would it occupy more than the diagonal parking that's directly to the east of the building now?
No, that's their proposal, is to just take those five spaces that are immediately adjacent to their station for several reasons. View corridor issues and height limit issues, but also if they were to go further in, then they're going to affect the flow. And as you know, we already have a challenge enough with big semi-trucks going around the end of their building to get over to the fish dock. If we were to if you were to cut off that traffic flow, that's the way into the pier. Medium-sized trucks can turn into there, go through the parking lot, and then get out to the pier. If we were to eliminate that, you couldn't get in front of our offices, between our office and the revetment, and turn that corner with anything other than a pickup truck or a vehicle. So that would have some pretty serious flow implications, which would mean changing the curb cuts and islands and everything else. So they don't have the funding for that. So that's where we're going with Coast Guard. Any other questions on that? Okay. Status of lease site management activities. The lease site, we talked a fair amount about that. I'm not going to talk anything really more about the policy itself, other than it's pretty high on my list to get that underway and get something to the City Council here sometime this fall. So I'm going to be working on that. There may be the possibility of a Harbor Advisory Board element to that, maybe an ad hoc committee, who knows, yet to be created. I know I'll be probably having a couple of different committees I'll put together with some leaseholders and maybe some HAB folks, so we'll see how that develops as that moves on. But my goal is to get that done sometime this fall is where I'm going with that one. Any other questions on that? Okay, finally, status of Harbor Department capital projects. So a couple of big capital projects. Beach Street slips. I've got shoreline engineering and Marwall construction. Working up preliminary engineering and design, and one of the big surprises that's come out of that. So the power that feeds those slips comes from the South T Pier. It's underneath the boardwalk now, unfortunately, and there's never any chaseways or any access ways put underneath the boardwalk to get to that those conduits. And so the service that services all those slips now to get new service in to modern code and standard, the conduits that are existing there now can't get new wires through it. It won't work. We've had an electric company look at it, and so the service that comes from the South T Pier is not going to work for pull a new service in unless we just dug it up and retrench the whole thing. So it's looking like the best place to come for power is going to be in the island right at the, if you stop on Beach Street at the stop sign there, the island right there between that and the kite shop is where there's a big transformer, I think, in the ground there. So it's going to have to come from there underneath the street to the slips that are right next to Giovanni's, and then we'll run it either along the revetment, in the revetment, or maybe from slip to slip, section to section to get the power to it. So that's been a big surprise financially and logistically, and so working up the cost estimates on that, and I'm just waiting on getting an engineering estimate on those to figure out what direction I'm going to go with those, because the project's gotten a heck of a lot more costly, and it's gotten more costly with some design changes in terms of configuration we've had to do because of eelgrass and other things, our favorite subject.
Would there be enough money to run the power and put a new ramp in?
Well, our hope is we've got to, I mean, it's got to get powered, so we're going to have to get power to it, and we're going to have to bring it to code, so we're going to have to do that part. Our plan now on the north slips is to eliminate that little walkout pier that goes, and then you hit the gangway down, eliminate that whole pier, and just do a gangway all the way across, which will really limit out the slope. It'll ease up the slope to that gangway a lot and eliminate that pier and get rid of all the pilings, which is a good thing. So that'll bring the cost down there. The gangway on the south side, as you know, on a low tide, it's like a mountain climb. There's not a lot of space there. We're trying to reconfigure it so it goes off at more of an angle and hits maybe a wider head float area so that it won't be able to meet any kind of ADA spec, but it'll definitely be better than how it is now, which is about a 45-degree slope on a low tide. That's our hope there, so. And then launch ramp. Launch ramp's kind of a tale of woe. So I went to DBW 5 years ago and to approach them about their grant program for launch ramps. They said, sure, absolutely, we've got money, let's do it. DBW said, our preference is we'll come to your site, you know, sort of tell us what you want to do project-wise. We'll do all the concept design and engineering cost estimates and give that to you, and then you take that and put it in your application, including the dollar amount, and apply for that amount of money. And we found that that gives us a better project because we've cost estimated it, and we think we can, you know, we know what we want and what we look for, and so we think that works better. And I said, okay, and I did that, and they gave me a one-page concept design that had 20-odd bullet points on it of things that we were going to do, and they came up with a cost estimate of, I can't remember the number, $1.7 million. I can't remember the number. And I applied for that, and it took me several years to get DBW to get it in their budget and to get the governor to approve it in the budget, and we did. And we got the grant, and the first grant we got was for $250,000, and that was to get us all the way through planning and permitting and designs and get us to 100% design level. So I started contracting with engineers and architects and a project manager, and DBW has to approve all those contracts. And so we started going back and forth with DBW and contract approval. And then about 4 months into that, they told us that they didn't want us to do individual contracts with an architect and an engineer and an asphalt person and a this person. They want it all under one big contract. So that threw my process into a little bit of a tailspin. And so as I started trying to cost it out in terms of contracting to see what my contract authority would be. We started looking at timeline and how to get this thing through. It became pretty apparent to us that the cost estimates they did for the one-page concept scope of work, there were several things that didn't match. The biggest one was the engineering concept plan page said that we were going to go in and re-asphalt, or at least scrape the asphalt and repave, because the asphalt is at its life limit. And it had 3 inches of asphalt designated on there. And the cost estimate that DBW had was, I want to say, $90,000 for the entire parking lot. Mm. And we looked at that, and we looked at the fact that Regional Water was almost in all likelihood going to require us to change that filter drain in the middle of that parking lot and put in bioswales and do all the new groovy stuff you do in a parking lot now to try and filter off the pollutants. $97,000 wasn't going to cut it. And when we went back to DBW with this little fact, they said, well, I guess, city, you're just going to have to make up the difference. And so we kind of scratched our heads and, well, that's not going to work. And we had a similar issue with the ADA. They had all the elements in the ramp were to be ADA connected, ADA accessibility connectivity through the thing. And their price tag on that, including the restroom, and their price tag on that was 80-some-odd thousand dollars. And when I had my project consultant go in and start really seeing what it needed for ADA, the only thing that was really ADA compliant was some of the pathway around the restroom. The interior of the restroom was not even close. All the pathway from the restroom to the fish cleaning station, all the way from the fish cleaning station over to the slips in the pay kiosk, was out of compliance, both in slope, too much cross slope, and if you go along that path where the slips are, toward on the ocean side of the path, the path just ends and drops off, and then it hits dirt and rock revetment. Well, you've got to have curbs and all kinds of other stuff, and so we looked at that and went, $87,000 isn't going to cut it. Went back to DBW, and they said, well, city, I guess you're just going to have to make up the difference. And so we scratched our heads again, and I went back to the city council, and I said, okay, I'm going to rescope this thing. I asked for $45,000 in funding to hire some consultants to do some analysis, do a little engineering. So I hired Earth Systems to go in and analyze the asphalt and indeed determine that it's shot and it needs to be scraped and re-asphalted. And then an ADA consultant to go in and look at the ADA connectivity and came up with real cost estimates. The parking lot was, I want to say, $400,000 or something. And all the ADA stuff was a couple hundred thousand. So I went back to DBW with that fact and said, your budget isn't going to match this scope. And they argued with us about scope, and they kept saying, well, you're just going to have to make up the difference, or gave us a couple options, none of which are really very viable. So I'm kind of left scratching my head. I don't want to throw in the towel and just give up this grant, but DBW's, and I don't know if they're listening right now, but I'm too tired. DBW is not making it easy to administer and implement this grant, so I'm not sure where we're going to go with that one.
Can the scope be restricted to just the launch ramp and its piers?
I've talked about that with my project consultant, and we've talked in pieces about that with DBW, that exact question. I thought, well, let's at least do the launch ramp, but maybe the fish cleaning station. The problem is they've taken the position that, okay, if you want to do that, then whatever line item number, whatever our dollar amount that we estimated for that item, that's the number. You can't just take the whole $1.7 million grant and do as much as you can. You're going to get the numbers that we gave you, and that's what you're going to do for that part. So that's exactly what I'm looking at now, to see what elements I can maybe pull out now where they've got good cost estimating, and see if I can do those. Obviously, the ramp's my number one, because that ramp is just toast. The boarding floats, and here's another permutation to this, is another head-scratcher. The number of parking spaces we have available in that lot, including the five or six extra overflow ones, according to DBW specifications, only justify a two-lane ramp. We have a three-lane ramp. There's the two lanes that have boarding floats, and there's one up the middle, which, as you know, I think there's one person, Harold Davis, that uses it because he's got enough chutzpah to bring his boat right up the middle in between everybody else. Most other people, when there's current and wind, just don't do that. So DBW's design has the ramps all getting skinnier, and we're arguing, no, you can't do that. You've got wind. You've got tide. People come in at this angle, and you need that extra space. Well, your parking lot only justifies two lanes. You're going to have to justify the extra cost or pay for it. And so I believe, and we've got to do the numbers analysis, the extra amount of dollars to make the concrete ramps 15 feet wider, I believe, should be significantly less than pulling up all the pilings and restabbing them down and redoing all the revetment work to make it skinnier. So that's the argument I've got to make. And if I can make that argument that it's going to cost less, which I believe I can do, they'll redo the abutments because they got to get ADA compliant, and then the apron up above, and then the ramps going down, and then the boarding floats will get replaced, and then new ramp, hopefully three lanes wide. Otherwise, if I put in a two-lane ramp, I'm going to get run out of town. So I'm not quite sure where I'm going to go on that one. So like I said, DBW is not making it easy.
Wow.
That's my tale of woe on the launch ramp.
Wow.
And that's all I got.
Wow. Okay, anything else for Eric on this particular agenda item, C6? Eric, thank you. This was a lot of work. Thank you. I really appreciate this on C6.
Yeah, no worries. Mostly talk, but...
No. This is just what we asked for. It's what we got. Okay, so that takes us to... Item D, declaration of future agenda items. Do we have any future agenda items that are not on the list that anybody would like to declare? Okay, seeing none, motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Okay, moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? None? Carries. Thank you.